Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time weekend in MMA set to go down with UFC 261 in front of fans. Maybe you were one of the lucky few that got tickets, but Matt, really looking forward to it. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. And to my left, your right, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. Matt, absolutely love the card. Absolutely stacked with three title fights up at the top. And listen, if you're an all-around MMA fan, you got the PFL coming back on Friday. You get the UFC on Saturday. There's all sorts of stuff to love. But looking ahead at this card, all sorts of great things. We got a great interview on the channel as well with Rude Boy Randy Brown. He's got a big fight coming up against Alex Cowboy Oliveira. I can barely contain my excitement. I love the card. What are you thinking?
It's such a fun fight card. We have rematches that people have been asking years for, like Chris Weidman, Uriah Hall. You probably thought I was going to say another fight. And of course, Kamaru Usman, Masvidal 2. We had the first fight, Masvidal, on short notice, only really about a week. So hopefully we do get a better version of that fight. But like you said, three title fights to cap this card off. And this is the first fight back in front of what should be a full house. So really excited for this weekend's pay-per-view.
Looking forward to it. And we've got a lot of fights to choose from. All said and done. There's about 13 scheduled for the card. We did just lose Johnny Munoz, who's supposed to be taking on Mark Striegel. And then eventually Jamie Simmons. But those two fights are out. Maybe some are added. Maybe some are dropped. You got to tune in with Fight Night Picks all week long. In case we do have any changes to the card. But Matt, let's flip it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, which is as always presented by Manscaped. And when we're talking about possible Fight of the Nights, we got to go with Hipster Pick for the first one. Bakary Dana, and it is a difficult name to go with. And listen, I actually learned, and I'm not lying about this one, from Joe Rogan, the last pay-per-view. That's the proper way to say his name. And he's taking on Kevin Natividad. And this one, to me, is an all-action type of matchup. Because for Bakary Dana, in his UFC debut, he took on Alatang Hei Lee. And he didn't look good. He looked like he was staring in a mirror. He was really, really tentative. He just did not look like his normal self. This is a guy that's been training over with Jackson Wink for some time. He's fighting out of Mongolia. And then he finally let his hands go against Guido Canetti in his last time out. And he looked absolutely sensational. He was the aggressor. He was very heavy-handed. And yeah, he can look a little stiff and robotic sometimes. But when he finally starts to flow, does this guy ever look impressive? For a guy who only has 10 pro fights opposite him, Kevin Natividad, a guy that can really mix it up well together. And in his last fight, he ended up losing to Miles Johns on incredibly short notice, coming in on 6 or 7 days notice. But if you saw his fight before that with LFA against Kyle Estrada, the guy looked absolutely amazing, knocked out Estrada. And listen, what can I say? He is a great fighter. Overall, love the matchup. This one should produce fireworks.
This is one of those fights early on in the card that really could steal the night and that the commentary team could be talking about for the rest of the evening. And really, I agree with everything you would say. We just have two really exciting young prospects on this card. And the great thing, too, is we've always got fights like this where they're kind of hidden down lower on the prelims, but it is something that we can get really excited for. And I do think that this fight with Bakary and Natividad should be absolute fireworks from start to finish.
And when we flip it over to our other pick, it's hard to cherry pick one of the title fights, but in our co-main event, we have Zhang Lee rematching, well, no, this is the first time, against Rose Namajunas. And that's a funny thing. When you look at Rose Namajunas, there's plenty of rematches and not a whole lot of fights on her overall body of work. So it's a fresh challenger. It's a fresh champion. You have Zhang Weili coming off of that crazy, crazy fight in front of fans against Joanna Jędrzejczyk her last time out. For Rose Namajunas, bit of a weird one her last time out.
Well, just for Rose Namajunas, it's kind of weird because the top of this division, it's sort of a triangle, but we can almost kind of open this up and make it more into a square because Jessica Andrade, Joanna Jędrzejczyk, Rose Namajunas, Weili Zhang, they've all fought each other so many times at this point, and the bell just keeps on switching hands between those four fighters, and really any combination of those four fighters is going to result in a fight of the night contender. You saw what Rose was able to do in her last fight against Jessica Andrade after she was pretty much just dropped on her head in their first fight. You saw the adjustments she was able to make and what a fun fight that turned into. And for Weili, possibly just coming off of one of the greatest fights in MMA history, I don't think that's much of a hot take. I could not be more excited for this co-main event.
Love these two picks for fight of the night. Let us know down below in the comments section what you're thinking with and who you're going with for possible fight of the night. But this screen, as always, presented by Manscaped. Make sure you check out our sponsor. It's manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping on your order today. And Matt, I'll save the ball talk for later on in the show, but we got a lot to talk about, so we'll just flip it on back over. Overall, big time card coming up this weekend with UFC 261. And if you're missing out, we have a website. You can find the podcast, you can find articles, all sorts of great stuff. Our full card betting guide that comes out later in the week with our own Joshua Hart. But also on the site, you got to check it out, fightnightpicks.com. We have the shop. And Matt, you've got the baseball jersey. Now listen, maybe if the MLB took sponsors, maybe your New York Yankees could take a jersey like this and maybe they make out a little bit better than they do with their own pinstripes. We also have the Under Armour Fight Night Picks t-shirt. And heck, I've got the MLG looking Fight Night Picks black long sleeve shirt. You can get all of that great stuff over at fightnightpicks.com. Matt, we have plenty of fights to talk about. You have no idea how much research I've done on the bottom three. I'm really looking forward to the card, and overall, it should be a great one. So, let's keep it going, and really looking forward to it. As we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks,
let's get into it.
And tentatively set to kick things off on our prelim portion of UFC 261, we have a couple of strawweight prospects in Brazil's Ariane Carnelosi making her second appearance with the promotion, taking on the UFC Academy winner out of the UFC PI in Shanghai, China. We have Na Liang, also known as Dragon Girl. Matt, for Liang, she's a fighter that a lot of people might already recognize. And if you go down through the list, there's plenty of fighters and fights that she's had against some names that you might recognize. Like I said, I mean, Lilia Shakarova being one of them. She had a one-off with Bellator against Juliana Velasquez, who would ultimately become their champion at 125 pounds. And another one on that list, Maria Agapova. Now, unfortunately, she lost all three of those fights. And you might think to yourself, well, geez, that's not very good. I mean, she is, however, 4-1 in her five on in. And so is Ariane Carnelosi. Now, for Liang, she's on a four-fight win streak. For Carnelosi, she did have that loss in her debut against Angela Hill. But the focus more so in this fight is on the newcomer, because we have three fighters representing the UFC PI in Shanghai, UFC Academy winners. You have a couple of names in Rong Zhu, and he's got a big fight against Kazula Vargas. But you also have a fighter whose name, and I will throw this one out there, I will dazzle it around and about, Archie Long, who's taking on Jeff Molina. For Na Liang, this is a really interesting one, because if you look at her style, to me, you'd think it plays well against somebody like Ariane Carnelosi. I mean, she is very grappling and wrestling heavy. She likes to get on top. She likes to try and get into position and then work a submission. If you look at her total body of work, 13 of her 15 wins are by finish, 9 of them by submission, 4 of them by knockout. She does have a tendency to shoot from very long out, and to me, it almost looks like desperation takedowns, and it starts very, very early on. Na Liang is not afraid to shoot from like the first 15 seconds, and she will lunge across the cage, go for your feet, go for whatever she can get, and it has gotten her into some very big issues. If you go back and watch that Juliana Velasquez fight, she shoots, she shoots, she shoots. And listen, the other thing about it, she used to fight at 25, she's fought at 115, and you're going to get beat by some of the bigger fighters. I mean, Juliana Velasquez is Bellator champ for a reason. She can grapple quite well. But you look at the other ones, I mean, the Maria Agapova fight, it was weird because you had Liang that almost pulled guard, and then Agapova got on top of her, and it was kind of a good night after that. Like, she didn't have offer up a lot of resistance. Lilia Shakarova, though, she lost to Lauren Murphy in her debut. Very, very accredited wrestler and grappler. If you've seen any of her fights, she's like, I don't know, like a tiny power plant in all of her fights, except for the Murphy fight. And then against, you know, you talk about it, Shakarova, Agapova, it is what it is. But when you look at a fight like this, for Liang, she's on a nice little win streak, like I said. She tends to kind of jump into position. The one thing that I don't like that I've heard out of her, she's had the one fight in the States, and she talked about it in a couple of different interviews. She said she was concerned about the diet and the weight cut for that one, and that was a problem the last time she fought in the U.S. I do just worry about that just a little bit for this one, but it's an interesting set of circumstances coming in here.
It really is, and I do like the weight that you had brought up, because for Carnelosi, I always look at her, and yes, she is one of the more heavily muscled fighters at strawweight, but I do think that she could fight at atomweight in the future.
She is one of the most muscled up fighters, period.
That's true, really, just regardless of weight class. But when I look at Carnelosi, I really do look at a fighter who, if I'm being honest, I do think atomweight is more suited to her weight class, because just height-wise, she gives up so much height on a lot of these women who she's fighting. And I know we're going to talk about Jessica Andrade a little bit later on, in the evening, but with Andrade, she can get past her height deficiency, I guess, because of the amount of power she brings to the cage. With Carnalusi, she has really good power, especially with her forward movement. We did not see the best version of her in her last fight against Angela Hill, though, and I do think that was just one of those cases of it was too much too soon for Carnalusi. It's a big ask for anyone to fight Angela Hill, really, in the top 15. She's one of those fighters, A, she loves to stay active, and B, she just is really well-rounded. And for Carnalusi, she had a little bit of success in that fight. Now, I'm not going to sugarcoat things. Angela Hill won pretty much every minute of that fight, but there were a few positives to take from that fight. Carnalusi, when she lands, she has big power for the division. You could tell that Angela Hill, who has been in there with just pretty much everybody at 115, she was able to land some really clean shots that they weren't stunning her, and they might not have been dropping Angela Hill, but you could tell that they were taking an effect. And I do think if Carnalusi could add the accuracy along with her punching power, we would be dealing with a very interesting fighter down at 115. And the thing for Carnalusi too, which is a little unfortunate, she's just not... I don't really know where her style fits into the division as a whole, because really, when you look at 115, you have your longer, rangier strikers, and then you have your really dominant grapplers, like your Carlos Spirases, your Tatiana Suarez's. For Carnalusi, it will be really interesting to see where she does fit into the division moving forward. And for Liang Na, there's one comp that I think you danced around it and you pretty much said it, but I'll just make it. She reminds me a lot of a much more green Mackenzie Dern. She reminds me of that version of Mackenzie Dern that we saw in her first couple UFC fights, just in that the comfort in her striking. She's definitely more comfortable in her striking than Dern was, especially in those early fights. Dern did not want to be on the feet. But in the fact that when Dern was having trouble on the feet in her strikes, she would just put her hands down by her knees and try to walk her way into those clinching positions. And for Leon... Nah, that's going to be really tough, especially against a power puncher like Carnalusi. So it will be really interesting to see how she chooses to strike her way into the clinch to try to get this fight to the mat.
And I mean, the thing again with Na Liang, I mean, you look at it, a wushu and wrestling base, and those things can go well together. I mean, we've seen plenty of wushu practitioners kind of pop up out of the...
Roy Nelson?
He's a kung fu guy, but... You still do see a little bit of wushu influence in certain styles. But again, with Liang Na, the striking isn't quite there. It's still very green. I would think that working at the PI under Dean Amazinger, it's still going to get better and better 100%. And better. You've got a lot of great training partners. And over at that PI, they haven't dumped millions and millions of dollars into that facility without trying to produce some stars. So Liang Na, maybe one of those fighters. But again, I look through it. I will say, I mean, she does roll well on the balls of her feet when she tries to strike. She doesn't throw a ton of kicks. She can strike from a 1-2, but then she's trying to clinch. Or from far out, she's trying to shoot. Like, it's just kind of, the bones are there. You can see it's there. It's just she's still so young. I mean, only 24, almost 25 years old. When she fought Juliana Velasquez, she was 21. So it's one of those things. You're going to mature as a fighter. She already has tons of pro experience for somebody that's this old. She was the martial arts cage 125-pound champ. She was a 2018 Asian MMA championship. And listen, I have to say this now that we're this far into it. If you're trying to find tape on her, I will explain how. You have to go into Tapology. You have to take the characters next to her name, you Google them, then you translate the page, and you can find plenty of fight tape. If you're ever looking for WLF Wars tape, and again, you've got Archie Lung, who's got a fight coming up. You also have Zhu Rong, or Rong Zhu, that has a fight coming up. You find them there, that's how you do it. But I was able to find it, again, Little Green, she can get out-wrestled by bigger wrestlers. That's another thing that I've seen even recently. And to throw it on over to Ariane Carnalusi, somebody that's training with Ketlin Vieira, with another name, Lara Procopio right now, over on the Instagrams. She also just got her Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt from her coach, Marcio Mendez, with M4BJJ. And over on his, and I had to translate it, but he had said she had won the No-Gi World Cup just about 8 weeks ago. So you can tell that Carnalusi, working on her BJJ, working on her grappling, I think that lends good credence into this fight. But again, she is very much a power puncher. You see it out of the finishes that she has. She's a Thunder Fight champ. You got the striker grappler. I would say more striking than grappling 100%. For sure. You get the grappler. Again, it is a clash of styles. If we look at the odds, Matt, I was a little bit surprised. We've had a huge amount of line movement recently on Carnalusi. She opened a minus 150. She's minus 189. For Liang, she opened a plus 130. She's now at a plus 155. And to me, I actually, as I was doing the research for this one, I put a little bit on Carnalusi, which I rarely ever do. I usually wait till the end of the week. Let's have a look at the Tapology votes. A surprise to us, 870 total votes, and you have 69% Carnelosi, 79% Haver by decision. What are you thinking here?
I do like Carnelosi in this fight, because where you look at what ranges this fight's going to be taking place at, it's going to be very close range for the majority of it. And I don't really like what I've seen out of Leong striking, whereas for Carnelosi, we've seen her struggle with those longer rangier strikers, but on the inside, like you had mentioned, she has power for days, especially at this weight division. So I do think if Carnelosi get defensive takedowns and really keep this into more of a boxing fight, she should be able to win this one.
With Carnelosi, you look at her, she can keep her hands quite low. She has quite a bit of a square stance as well, and good takedown defense. So yeah, I really do like Brazil's Carnelosi in this fight. The first of our three Chinese fighters representing the PI on this card, we have Liang Na taking on Ariane Carnelosi, and Matt, both of us going with Carnelosi. So overall, really looking forward to the card. Three title fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss those. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, Matt, let's get into it. Here at Fight Night Picks, we've been rocking the Flyweight Never Die for the longest time, since about 2018 when the show started. And listen, Flyweight Never Die, we've got a great fight between a couple of debuting fighters in Jeff Molina, El Jefe, taking on. And listen, for everybody at home, this is going to be a little bit of a class. I even checked with a recent interview from the South China Morning Post, our friend of the show, JHK MMA, and he said, yep, you got it. So, it's Archie Long. Archie Long, not Aori Keelang. It's Archie Long, if you're going with the pronunciation. And he's coming out of the UFC's PI. He was one of the Academy winners. There are three fighters from the UFC Shanghai PI competing on this card. You have Liang Na, you have Archie Long, and you also have Rong Zhu. And listen, the Mongolian murderer, what a fun fighter to watch. Holy smokes, can this guy absolutely finish a fight? You want to go back and see a fun one? It was his last time out, not that long ago, back in January. He took on Kizri Abdulayev, knocked him out in the second round, and listen, it was just an absolutely crazy left hook in close to the cage, dropped him, referee hopped in, that was all she wrote. But plenty of finish wins on his record. Really nice wide stance, decent wrestling, very heavy on top, and just overall a well-rounded fighter, a guy that you like to see. Now, he will kind of tend to give one to take one. He'll end up with quite a bit of pressure. He's taking on a really, really dynamic fighter in Jeff Molina, and you can laugh and snicker all you want over on the Instagrams. This was a guy last year that won a couple of awards with his gym, Glory MMA and Fitness. He was the best teammate. He was the most improved fighter. And he really put it on at the end of last year. And I mean, you look at it, he gets the win over Jacob Silva in Contender Series back in August. It was a decision win. And normally, decision winners, you end up in the UFC. Dana White was really impressed with him. Molina said after the fight, he was walking around, he's like, listen, I broke my foot in the first round. It is what it is. It was a really, really good win for him. But apart from that, this guy's an absolute finisher. You look at him too. I mean, he started his career off 1-2. And since then, he's won every single fight impressively, even in that decision. Very young fighter coming into this one at 23, almost 24. Matt, I absolutely love the fight. I think stylistically, this is a great one. A very exciting fight at 125 pounds. I can't wait to get your thoughts.
I know we both love the flyweight division, and I think the thing that I love most about the flyweight division is the fact that really only one or two wins can get you into that top 15, and I do think we're dealing with two very exciting young prospects who do have a chance to get into that top 15. Now, I'm not saying win this fight and then you're ready for Brandon Moreno or anything, but just this division is so talent-stacked that really anyone in the division could beat anyone in the division, regardless of ranking next to their names, and that's why it's so exciting. You had mentioned a little bit about Jeff Molina and just how well he is at such a young age. And the great thing about Molina is he fights like a fighter who is much older than he already is. We talk a lot about, oh, well, this fighter, we like a lot of things about their game, but oh, if they could just get it all together, they could just get it all together. Well, at the age of only 23, Jeff Molina doesn't have everything together, of course. He is still a very young fighter, but he fights with the maturity of someone who has had more than just 10 professional fights to their names. One thing I really like about Molina, we were kind of joking about it, I compared him to Zion Williamson, because one thing I really like about Zion is that when he shoots the ball, if he thinks he's going to miss it, he's already got that second jump ready to go up for the rebound. The thing I really like about Molina and his kicking game, to be more specific, is the fact that Molina, he'll throw a kick, and even if you do block it, I think about Israel a little bit, where Israel, all of a sudden, throws the right kick, and as he's bringing the leg down, he throws the right hand. Well, with Molina, as he's throwing the kick, when he's bringing that down, he's already got another kick ready to be chambered and go right back in. And this is a really neat thing to see from a prospect, because normally you don't see those same side attacks from guys so early in their career. career. Really, you don't even see it from guys who are into their 30s, who are ranked. So it's just a really nice wrinkle to see out of a guy who is so young in a division that's just so exciting. And for Archie Long, that's the really fun thing. He's going to bring a lot to this fight that Jeff Molina just won't be used to. Now, the one thing about Archie Long that I don't love about his record is, it's not that his record's padded, but I wouldn't say he's fought the best level of competition the whole way through. He's fought just a lot of good fighters. And the one thing that we always say is, it's not enough to just beat guys, you have to beat them impressively. Now, the good thing about him is that he has gone out there and finished the majority of guys that he should be at least supposed to win. You hate to say he's supposed to win an MMA fight, but when he is in there against the guys who are the 3 and 5s, the 5 and 1s, normally he is the one finishing them, which is, you know, what you really like to see. So I could not be more excited for this fight at flyweight.
I mean, yeah, that's actually a weird thing. So 11 of his 18 wins are by decision. He's got 6 by knockout, but he's on a 6-fight win streak, and out of those, 4 of them are by finish. So it is starting to pick up a little bit. And if you look at it, it's weird, right? Because you look into his third pro fight, he lost to Grigory Popov, who ended up in UFC and went on an absolutely awful run. But he was late in his career. It was weird. Again, you never know what you're getting from WLF Wars. You get an absolute diamond, you get an absolute dud. And you look at another one of the fights from WLF Wars in 2017, it was a unanimous decision loss to Kai Kara-France. So in the middle of all of the fights, there are some decent fighters, but you look at it in that 6-fight win streak, 3-3, 18-16-2, 10-3, 4-4, 5-3, 5-1, Kizri Abdulayev and Amiran Amirov in his last two. Pretty decent wins. And the other thing that I like about it too is the fact that we're basically talking the end of 2018 until 2020. Very active as well. So you do like to see that out of Archie Long. And in a fight like this, it is really difficult to try and kind of give you a great prediction because, again, the fight tape's out there. You take the characters next to Archie Long's name over on Tapology, pop them into Google, translate the page. You're going to find tons and tons of fights. But it is kind of tricky. I mean, for Jeff Molina, he was supposed to compete back in January. It didn't happen. He was supposed to take on Zaruk Adashev, which honestly would have been a way easier fight than this fight. Because Jeff Molina is very well-rounded, and Zaruk Adashev is a striker, and, well, that's about all Zaruk Adashev
pretty much
is. So, I look at that, he was out due to COVID, and his exact words in, well, another interview with JHK over with SCMP MMA, his words were, it f***ed me up. So, yeah, it can happen, and even went as far as, like, saying, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, it's not that bad, it won't be that bad, and if I get it, I'm healthy, and it's not, and it was pretty bad for him. So, if it ruined one of my favorite pitchers, Eduardo Rodriguez's full 2020, then it's probably pretty friggin' bad, but Jeff Molina had it, unfortunate for him. Great to see him back. He predicts a second round finish in this fight. That's going to be tough. That's going
to
be really tough.
It is going to be tough to get the finish, but the one thing you do like about Molina is that, A, he can get it done on the feet, but he's also very adept on the mat as well. This is a guy who, a lot of his submission wins do come from the fact that he can hurt you on the feet, then submit you on the mat, and I know I'm feeding that fed horse, but it's a wrinkle in people's games that you don't see it that often, but it is just a great sign. If you have the ability to hurt somebody on the feet and not wear yourself out going for those TKO finishes where, oh, I'm getting a lot of arms, and oh no, the guy survived, what am I going to do now? The thing about Molina is that he can just go to a submission after it does get on the mat. So personally, I really do like Jeff Molina in this fight, and I do think he's got the higher ceiling out of these two, but I think this will be a very fun fight early on this card.
I have a really hard time with this one. So let's talk about the odds, because it's pretty much a pick 'em fight. I mean, Molina opened a minus 105 favorite. He's now a minus 109. Archie Long opened at a minus 115. He's a minus 113. So I should say that the fighter out of China is the favorite in this one ever so slightly. If we look at the Tapology votes, 864 of them, 63% going with Archie Long, 74% by decision. The 37% that have Molina, 72% by decision. You get the Mongolian Murderer taking on El Jefe. If it was a battle of the nicknames, it's an easy pick. 9 times out of 10, I'm going with Mongolian Murderer. El Jefe's all right, but it is what it is. I do have a really hard time with this fight, Matt. Obviously, it's a coin flip in terms of the odds. It'd be easy for me to just take the cop out of saying over. I'd say even over like 2 rounds, but I'd like to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I just think Molina is the more well-rounded out of the two, and the fact that he has fought the slightly higher level of competition. Now, the experience factor does not favor Molina, but I do think that's one of those things that you haven't done it until you have, and I do think that this will be his opportunity to really get a good win under his belt and really introduce himself to the UFC audience.
If Archie Long threw more kicks, I'd like him a lot more in this fight. And listen, as far as the wrestling's concerned, I definitely favor Jeff Molina. And to correct myself from earlier, he was the 2020 Gym Breakout Professional. He wasn't the most improved. He was the Gym Breakout Professional from the James Krause. And you'd say, hey, Craig, his real name's James Krause, but his nickname's The, and it's the worst in all of MMA. Mongolian Murder is way better than that. I have a hard time. I am going to go ever so slightly with Jeff Molina. But again, if you're going with Archie Long, way to go. I could definitely see a path for both guys. Maybe something crazy happens during this week. Maybe I end up switching my pick over in question mark kicks. We'll see what happens. I'll watch more of that fight tape that's very, very hard to find. But it is there. But for right now, both of us going with Glory MMA and Fitness's Jeff Molina to get the win. I can't wait for this fight. This is so well matched and so interesting out of two fighters making their respective UFC debuts. Can't wait for it. Three title fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss the rest of our UFC 261 coverage. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Really exciting fight at lightweight. We have our third debuting fighter out of the UFC's PI over in Shanghai. The UFC Academy prospect, Rong Zhu, taking on Kazula Vargas. Matt, it is an interesting fight because for Vargas, you look at it. I mean, he didn't have the sexiest record coming into the UFC. You look at the five on in, it's 2-3. And so far in the UFC, he took on Leko Alex da Silva. And then his last time out, he took on Brock Weaver. Alex da Silva was one of those guys that got really hyped up by Michael Bisping, of all people, in his debut, and it didn't go all that great, but overall, still a young prospect, lots of experience on the regional scene. He was ultimately able to win out over Vargas, and to me, the problem with Vargas coming into the UFC, and especially the problem in that fight, he's a really low output power guy. If you want to go see a fun fight of his, it was against, well, a familiar name that's now in the UFC at 170 pounds, Jordan Williams, back at Tachi Palace Fights 19 in 2014. And it was just an absolute knock him out, drag him out type of fight. He ends up finishing him in the first round. There's a cut, doctor stoppage. But if you look at it for Vargas, he's kind of already been in the spot. Like, in his debut, he took on the young prospect, he lost the young prospect, and he got beat handily in every single round. For Rong Zhu, this guy is the most impressive to me out of the three debuting fighters out of the PI in Shanghai that I've seen. I mean, wow. I love the fights. I get it. I mean, he has so many fights. He's only 21. He just turned 21. He took his first pro fight at 16. He's 17-3. And if you watch the way that this guy fights, it's very, very fun. And he really brings the fight to a lot of his opponents. I can't wait for this one.
It should be a really, really interesting matchup. Now, the problem for Kazula Vargas is going to be that he's got that weird kind of plodding forward style. Now, if he does fight those upper echelon strikers at lightweight, I think we all know how that fight's probably going to end. He's going to get pieced up, and then anyone with good footwork can probably get out of the way. Now, with Rong Zhu, he's not of that upper echelon in the lightweight division, and it will be interesting to see really where his ceiling is, because at only 21 years of age, every time we see this guy for really the next while, like every single fight for the next 2, maybe even 3 years, he is going to get better time after time after time. And for Kazula Vargas, I hate to say it, feels like he is being brought in right now as kind of one of those showcase opponents, but let's just call it what it is. You have a guy who is 0-2 in his UFC run right now, fighting the very hyped up prospect coming out of China. So I don't know if I'm as down on this fight as maybe you might be, but I don't know what Vargas is going to have for Rong Zhu that can really, really make this fight tough for him, because in my mind, I do see Vargas as that plodding forward kind of style. And the problem he's going to have a lot is, and just really to bring it back to what this weekend's main event was, Gaslam is a great boxer. He's really good on the inside, really good on the outside. But his issue is that when he moves forward, he really only does it in a singular direction, where if you do fight somebody who has great left and right movement, they're going to be able to counter you on the inside, kind of like I mentioned, and then use their footwork to get out of the way. I kind of see some parallels being drawn between this weekend's main event. I know those guys are almost title level, and these guys are very new level to the UFC, but I do see this going very similar. If Vargas can land a big shot and get this fight to the mat, I do see him having success. But my issue is, for Rong Zhu, he's got that great accuracy on the inside. And the other thing I like too is the variety of attacks that he can throw at Vargas. For Vargas, he really only is going to get it done with the hands. He can incorporate some kicks into his game plan, but we know him more as a sort of overhand-centric fighter, where for Rong Zhu, if he can keep this fight, the more technical he can keep this fight, the better. If he can keep everything short and in the middle and really just be counter-heavy, I can see him running away with a decision in this fight.
I look at Rong Zhu and you look at all the wins. I mean, 17-3 overall. 11 of those 17 wins are by knockout. knockout, 10-fight win streak that he's bringing into this one. You look at the second-to-last fight. You look at some of the names, and this was the same thing that we did in, well, our last preview with Archie Long. And you go, okay, well, you know, 0-1, 18-5, 10-9, 0-4, 17-5, 9-7. But back it up to the second-to-last fight. He beat Sha Yilan, and you might think, okay, 17-5. This guy's debuting in the UFC next month. Like, this is a UFC-caliber win, and he knocked him out in the first round. And if you go back and watch that fight, he eats a right hand for dinner when it starts, and then he just starts to give it back. Very, very technical fighter. Holds his hands nice and high. Really nice, almost tie stance with his hands up like that. He'll whip out a lot of kicks as well. Again, this guy is the one that I'm most highest of out of all three fighters that we have coming out of the UFC's PI in Shanghai. So I've tipped my hand, but I mean, I look at it. He goes jab, jab, and then a big right hand to follow it up. Like, he throws a lot of great boxing combinations too. Listen, this is a guy with a ton of upside. Obviously, you can see it from the age. You can see it from the amount of fights that he's had. But he's an absolute machine.
Now, I once said Jonathan Martinez is going to basically become the GOAT. And I looked dumb because...
You don't have to apologize every week for it.
Don't worry. I am going to play devil's advocate to tell you how Kasulu Vargas might be able to win this fight.
Wrestle!
Exactly. If he can... Get this fight chest to chest and make it as ugly as possible, because the more range that there is in this fight, the more success that Rong Zhu is going to have as this fight progresses too. And the thing about Vargas, he can sometimes duck and then throw with power over the top. Now, if he does do that, he can become a little bit predictable with his style. And if you do have a really good counter striker, like what we're dealing with in this fight, I do think anyone who is predictable like that can get picked apart, especially as the fight progresses. So for Vargas, he does have to make this fight really ugly. And I understand that's much easier said than done. But again, get it to the cage. Make it ugly. Try for the trip takedowns. Do everything you can to just not make this fight be an open space. And I do think Vargas can have some success in this fight. But my issue is he might only have success for minutes that way. I really don't see him going out there and being able to keep that kind of pressure or sustained pressure for those 8, 9, 10, 11 minutes that are going to have to be enough to win him two of these three rounds. So I do like Rong Zhu in this fight.
And we talked about Vargas in his debut against Alex Da Silva. He gets taken down. He just gets outclassed in that fight. He looked decent against Brock Weaver until the illegal knee. But again, when he's working in tight, when he's trying to work in the takedowns, when it's Kasulu Vargas' fight, he's usually the bigger fighter in most of his contests. Again, we talked about the weight, former welterweight. He is going to give up height and a little bit of reach in this one. If we're talking about the odds, Rong Zhu open a minus 250. He's still about there now. And if you look at Kasulu Vargas, about a plus 210. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, 872 of them, 87% Rong Zhu, 73% by knockout for the Kasulu Vargas fans, 40% by decision, 43% by knockout. I really do think that Rong Zhu looks like a finished product from all of the tape that I've watched on him for a 21-year-old prospect. The guy's first fight, he was 16 years and 2 weeks old, and he won by DQ. But after that, it kept opening up and he kept fighting. I really do like Rong Zhu in this fight.
I like Rong Zhu in this fight as well. Now, here's the thing. I'm not going to jump on the hype train just yet. Now, I will be a casual observer. I'll wave as it goes by. But I do think that Vargas is going to make this a very ugly fight. And here's the great thing about Rong Zhu. It's going to make us learn something about him and really make us learn something about where his UFC career is going to take him after this fight. So I agree with you. I've got Rong Zhu as well.
Matt, both of us going with China's Rong Zhu to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. We have three title fights up at the top. We're talking strawweight, flyweight, well, really, flyweight, strawweight, and then welterweight. Big time card. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Neat fight at bantamweight. We have a couple of prospects looking to really capitalize on a big fight, well, against their respective opponents. We have Hawaii's Kevin Natividad making his second time out. Quicksand, he's going to be taking on Bakari Dana. Storm. And listen, Storm is an interesting nickname for him because sometimes, just like the weather in the Maritimes, you could end up with snow. Sometimes you get rain. Sometimes you get a hot, sunny day. But for Storm Bakari, you look at his debut and he took on Alateng Haile and he didn't look all that good. He kind of got caught in the mirror. He looked really square. He got hit on the left side over and over and over again. And overall, he just got outclassed. So he came out, took some time off, and he ended up fighting Guido Caneni last year. And what do we know about Guido Caneni? Kind of a jack of all trades, but not really good at any of them. And if you go back and watch that fight, Bakari looked amazing in that one. He really did. I mean, he ultimately ends up getting the first round finish. For Kevin Natividad, made his UFC debut on incredibly short notice. It was about 6 days' notice. and he had just fought a week before with LFA in a main event. He was taking on Kyle Estrada, finished him in that fight. It was great shovel hook, right up, straight up, and he looked amazing in that one. And the one thing for Kevin Etivida that you hear fight and fight and fight again is that he's super heavy on his lead leg, and if anybody was a good kicker, they'd take advantage of it. He's had 11 pro fights, he's lost twice, and he didn't really get kicked a whole lot in the lead leg by Miles Johns. So, hey, maybe Bakary Dana is going to be the guy that figures it out. Eventually, somebody will. But we have a really interesting fight between a couple of guys that are very well-rounded. If you look at it for Bakary Dana, he trains primarily at a Jackson Wink. The past week or so, he's been at Extreme Couture, getting in some rounds in Vegas for this one. Ultimately, the fight is in Jacksonville. And for Kevin Etivida, coming out of Arizona Combat Sport, we've seen he has a decent wrestling pedigree, he has really, really quick hands, and he can box, and he can ultimately get in a firefight. We had this one circled as a possible fight of the night. I'd love to get your thoughts on it.
This is going to be a very exciting fight. Now, I also have to be very honest. I could see maybe a tiny little percent of the world where this isn't a good fight, where we do have two guys who will kind of look in the mirror, because that's the thing about Dana Bakary. His two fights that we have seen from him, he reminds me a little bit of Dwight Grant, where we've seen these versions of Dwight Grant where you're like, wow, could he be champion one day? And then you've seen other versions of Dwight Grant where it's like, did my TV freeze? Because he hasn't really done anything. And that is the interesting thing for Bakary, because the version of him where he is very active and he is letting his hands go, well, okay, we're dealing with a rangy striker with really good power, good cardio, good output. I like all of those things. And against Natividad, this will be interesting, because I do think Natividad's the more likely of the two to shoot a takedown at some point in this fight. But for me, it's going to come down to, when does he feel comfortable enough to start shooting those takedowns? Because I think we're dealing with two guys who have good cardio, but if they do get pushed, I think either guy could really make the other one really tired and be able to weaponize their cardio and their pace in that third round. Because if Bakary can make this a stand-up fight where he's defending a lot of takedowns in open space, he is backing up, and not just backing up straight. That's an issue too. If Natividad is able to just let his combinations go and then mix in his wrestling, I know I always bring up Frankie Edgar, but he's the first guy who I think of. If he really is able to mix in his hands with his wrestling, it's going to be a tough night for Bakary. And the thing about Dana Bakary is, if he is defending a lot of takedowns, and if Natividad is starting to become successful with his takedown attempts, those hands of Dana are going to drop a little bit more and a little bit more every single time. That is something that Natividad might be able to capitalize on later on in this fight. I really do think that his takedowns, maybe not for takedown's sake, I would use my takedowns to really set up my striking, because if he really is making Dana Bakary really just think constantly, think about the takedown attempt, then think about the strikes. Don't just let Bakary be comfortable in space, because if he is comfortable in space, I do think he'll be the more successful of these two fighters.
It's a really interesting clash of styles, really, and I mean, that's the thing for Bakary Dana. You can tell why you would go to Jack's Wink. You're going to get to work your boxing with Brandon Gibson, but then you go over and you look at the fighters that he's training with. Let's go over the whole period of time, because before the fight against Kennedy, I went back and watched, and I went back and looked through the Instagram. It was Aaron Pico, who was at Jackson Wink at the time. It was Patchy Mix, who's super on the outs with Jackson Wink right now, so you don't want to even mention the gym around him, but that's somebody that's great to train around, especially when you're getting ready for a fight with a guy like Kevin Etivida. Now again, that was for the Kennedy fight. That was a while ago. But the skills that you learn there, you're still going to keep with you. It's a lifelong game, this martial arts. And for Kevin Etivida, it is interesting taking on a guy that can strike, that can most likely defend some of the takedowns. The guys that Bakary's been with lately, I wrote it down. Steve Garcia and Damon Blackshear. And you might think, oh, okay, that's a neat name. The first MMA event I ever covered, Damon Blackshear was in the main event. So it's been a while. With NEF, it was kind of crazy. I saw that name pop up. I looked, I thought, is that him? Yeah, it was. So kind of cool. But yeah, it is a really interesting fight. And I was surprised, Matt, when I looked at the odds. Bakary Dana open a minus 150 favorite. He's minus 172 right now. For Kevin Etivida, open a plus 130. He's now at a plus 141. Have not looked at these Tapology votes. Yowzes. 876 total votes, 77% going with Bakary to get the win, 58% by decision, 36% by knockout. For the 23% that have Natividad, 69% by decision. Again, if you look at Kevin Natividad's overall body of work, he did beat Tom Nee back in 2018 by decision, but apart from that, there are plenty of knockout wins on his record. And for Bakary Dana, if we go through the record just quickly, There is a number of decisions, but he can get the submission. He didn't really fight the highest level competition coming into the UFC, so it was very difficult to try and know what you have. But we have seen him in two different fights. It has been a tale of two fighters. For me, I wouldn't be overly confident in a pick either way, to be totally honest with you.
No, I'm ever so slightly going to pick Bakhtiar Dinab, but unlike the Tapology voters, I'm not that confident in it. Now, I think he will be able to defend the few takedown attempts that he will see, and I do think he's the more comfortable of the two strikers, so if this fight is taking place at range, I do think he'll be the one scoring at a slightly higher output, but again, I'm kind of siding with you. I'm not as confident as those Tapology votes might suggest.
Yeah, I do have a hard time with this one. For Kevin Nate Tibbetat, it's a lot of long, lunging shots. He gets caught up the middle. He gets struck up the middle quite a bit. And if you want to go back, it's not just the Miles Jones fight, because again, he did get caught by that uppercut as he was like lunging back, and then he just kind of laid down and didn't get back up. Hey, sleepyhead, it's time. The fight's over, buddy. But it was a really good shot. And in that fight, kind of started to slow. Now, again, it was 6 days' notice, and he just fought, like, 7 days beforehand or 11 days before.
Exactly. I don't think he has bad cardio, and I don't think that that first fight from Nate Tibbetat is the best showcase of what Kevin Nate Tibbetat really can do in the cage. So I guess that might be why the odds where they are, but yeah, I still am picking Dinab Bakhtiari.
I'm going to go with Kevin Nate Tibbetat. Really? I think if he pushes a nice pace, again, we saw Dinab Bakhtiari really start to land some of those hooks, really start to land on Guido Canetti, and Guido was backing up. Oh, old Guido.
Poor Guido.
Yeah, we just never got to see enough of Guido. And he got kind of old, and then he lost to Bakhtiari Dinab, and then we never really saw him again. But I will ever so slightly side with Nate Tibbetat, because I think it's just going to be the constant pressure. The pressure, the pressure, the pressure. And coming in on short notice and, well, losing two rounds against Miles Jones and getting finished in the third, sometimes that's going to happen. Miles Jones, not really known as a cardio king either, but we'll see how this fight plays out. It is a really tricky one. Make sure you tune in to Question Mark Kicks. We get to see both these guys weigh in face off. Maybe it'll be a difference of the pick, because like we said, neither one of us overly confident with it. So let us know down below in the comments section who you're going with and why. I'm going Nate Tibbetat right now. You're going with Bakhtiari Dinab, but absolutely love the fight because it is a potential fight of the night. Love this card. Three title fights up at the top. UFC 261. Full of bangers in Jacksonville. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Neat fight coming up at UFC 261. We have Boondock Tristan Connolly representing the Lower Mainland in BC, taking on Pennsylvania's own Pat Sabatini. And Matt, for Tristan Connolly, you might look at the graphic next to us and say, what? Like, that doesn't make any sense. No, trust me, it does. He's going to be taking this fight at featherweight against Pat Sabatini. Well, a featherweight. And for Tristan Connolly, it was a short notice call up his last time out, which was a very, 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 very long time ago, back in the year 2019. Matt, 2019 was a great year. It was the second year of Fight Night Picks. And for Canada's Tristan Connolly, he picked up a huge win. He was a plus 350 underdog, plus 400 on some sites against Michelle Pereira. And in that fight, I don't know what happened to Michelle after like the first round, but I know you're going to like this lyric. They asked me if I'm lying. It was like Michelle Pereira was at the club and he had been drinking some proper 12. And in round two, well, he said, I say really, really. I'm really out of my mind. I say really, really. And he just kept pounding that proper 12 in between rounds because Tristan Connolly took over that fight. Michelle Pereira decided, I'm going, well, like the YouTube channel, all gas and no brakes. And then he absolutely gave out. And the much smaller man out-grappled him to a decision win. And it was probably the biggest shock in my entire life watching MMA was that fight, Matt.
Craig Allen, a prop comedian now? But no, it really was a shock because no one had any expectation for Tristan Connolly going into that fight. We all knew how good Michelle was and how crazy his highlight reel was about really the moonsaults and the crazy kicks and whatnot. And no one ever considered that that Canadian on a week's notice moving up a weight class really ever had a chance in that fight. But Tristan Connolly showed true grit in that fight, if nothing else. He really did show that, hey, it's going to take a lot more than some fancy movement and some crazy kicks to get me out of here. Tristan Connolly, we like to throw the word scrappy around, but Tristan Connolly really is just one of those scrappy fighters.
And look at the picture!
Exactly.
He looks like a guy that's been fishing on a boat for 25 years, and well, I guess it's time to pack up. Now we gotta grapple again.
Tristan Connolly's the type of fighter who, Paulo Costa probably has nightmares about guys like Tristan Connolly, because Tristan Connolly was made to take advantage of fighters like Michel Pereira, like Paulo Costa. If you're a really good striker and you get tired, Tristan Connolly is out there to drag you into the deep waters. And we know him because he is. He's tougher than a $2 steak, but he also does have that crazy cardio and just that crazy, and I know this is going to sound cliche, but that crazy will to win. If Tristan Connolly is conscious, he's going to try to win the fight, and he is going to have that constant kind of zombie forward movement where no matter what happens, Tristan Connolly is the one going to be moving forward in the majority of his fights, and that's what you have to like him for.
Now, Matt, you could call him Tristan, you could call him Connolly, or every time, you can call him Tristan Connolly. That's fine. He's taking on Pat Sabatini. If I know anything about Pat Sabatini, Pat Sabatini's a good fighter.
He is.
I'm just kidding. For Sabatini, this is a guy that's supposed to make his debut, well, not that long ago. And listen, if you're a big MMA fan, maybe you saw that last week we were supposed to have Josiane Nunes taking on Zara Farron. Well, Zara Farron, pre-fight, decided to do what Pat Sabatini's last opponent did. We're going to set weight for record-missing weight losses. And holy smokes, for Sabatini, who's going to be taking on Rafael Alves. And when we did the prediction, go back and check it out. We do a pretty good breakdown, I'd like to think, of both guys.
A fight we were really excited for.
We're really excited for it. Ultimately, we had Alves winning. But I even said in that video, he is the bigger fighter. This guy should not fight at 50 or 45. And if he does, his cardio is going to be an issue. Well, that didn't matter because he weighed, what, 157 and a half? And Sabatini was left without a fight. So he comes back into this one. And if we know anything about Pat Sabatini, the guy's very well-rounded. He's a good striker. My comparison going into the Alves fight was that Sabatini's a little bit like a Charles Rosell. Switch stances. He's a little boxy with his striking, but he can get it done. And if you go back and you look through his record, he has three losses. The first one, Robert Whatley decision. The second one, Jose Marcial or Marcial back in 2018. He beat Damon Blackshear that we just talked about. And then he had a loss to James Gonzalez at CFFC 81. Now, this guy, two-time featherweight champ with CFFC. He lost his belt to Gonzalez because he had his elbow totally dislocated. It's one of the most disgusting injuries I've ever seen. And I saw Vince McGuinness dislocate his elbow against Ryan Sanders, where he basically did the Talladega Nights Pepe Le Pew tap, or I'm going to break it. And he broke it, and it was gross. But in that fight, it happens to Sabatini, and it happens. So he did only take off about 7 months between that fight when he took on Jordan Tatone, and then he fought Jesse Stern. Not great records from both of those two guys, but Pat's still getting it done. From Tristan Connolly, like I said, really long layoff. The Pereira fight was back in September 2019. He was supposed to take on Leko Alex da Silva back last year in Portland. It would have been a bit of a hometown game. You're close to Vancouver area, but ultimately it fell out. So for Connolly, he had a neck injury. His wife had a kid in the summer. It's been a long while coming back. He has been training out of Extreme Couture to get ready for this one. I saw him down in Vegas early, kind of getting the rounds in. And the guys that he had with him, Jeremy Kennedy, he's been training also at 10th Planet with Alon Cruz in some of the pictures, and at Extreme Couture at Julian Arosa. He's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. Opposite him, Sabatini, also a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. And that's a guy that trains out of Gracie's in Philly. And we talked about Gracie Philly fighters before, but Jonathan Webb was one of those guys. Another one of the big fighters is Sean Brady, of course, as everybody knows. But there are a lot of good fighters out of that gym as well. I love the matchup because stylistically, somewhat similar in the grappling and the wrestling departments. I think Sabatini has an edge in the striking. He also has a pretty damn big edge in, well, age. I mean, he's about 5 years younger. But for Connolly, been out for a while. Time to recover and recuperate. Enjoy British Columbia for all it's worth. Ultimately, what do you make out of this one?
So the things about Tristan Connolly that I don't love going into this fight are the things that you had mentioned. A, he is 35, making his return from 170, and the weight cut does worry me a little bit. I do know he has fought at 145 earlier in his career.
So the last time that he fought at 145 pounds, you bring out the paper notes for this stuff, was back very, very, and I gotta keep saying it, very long time ago. It was back in 2015 against Mario Pereira. He ultimately lost that fight by decision. That was a BFL 39 Halloween Hell. Great name, BFL.
There you go. Just a great marketing ploy. I worry about Tristan Connolly. With the neck injury, with him being 35, with him going down to a weight class he hasn't fought at in over 5 years, it's just a lot that does concern me. And really, when I look at the places Tristan Connolly can have success in, it's, okay, he's got good wrestling, he's got that black belt in jiu-jitsu, and if he does get top position, we know how dirty he can be on top. It's not like Pat Sabatini, some slouch off of his back, or even when it comes to takedown defense. So I do think if Sabatini could just make this a striking matchup between these two, he has the wrestling defense. I think he has the cardio to be able to at least keep Connolly off him and at range throughout this fight. I am going to pick Pat Sabatini. But for Connolly, if he can prove me wrong at the age of 35 down to weight class that he has yet to compete at in the UFC for, good on him. That will be really, really impressive, and it will be a great springboard for him to fight other guys. But I just like Pat Sabatini.
9-1 in his last 10 fights for Tristan Connolly. And you look at the win streak, he beat Prince Edward Island's Lenny Wheeler at Elite One MMA back in 2017. Shouts to all those Moncton, New Brunswick MMA fans. But ultimately, it is an interesting fight with the odds. Sabatini, pretty big favorite. Open a plus 105. That line dropped and adjusted very quickly. He's now minus 234 favorite. With Connolly, open a minus 125. He's now a big underdog at about a plus 187 or thereabouts. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, wow, that's a bit of a surprise. 799 total votes, 63% Connolly, 85% by decision. The 37% that have Sabatini, 70% by decision. For me, I really like the striking out of Sabatini. I'll be interested to see how Connolly makes out because he's been in Vegas for a little bit now. It seems like, what, a month, a couple months at least over on the Instagrams. But you take advantage of the Performance Institute, especially if you're somebody coming from BC down to Vegas. You're, you know, I don't know what his lodging situation is, but at least you get your foods and your meal prep done. So I'm sure the weight cut was done, you know, successfully. It was done the right way. Am I worried about it slightly? Because again, this guy's pretty well a lightweight. And then his last fight was a one-off at 70 on super short notice, and he picked up a huge win, and that's why you see it on the graphic before you. But Sabatini, tried and true featherweight, made weight like a pro the last time out against Alves, who made a career weight miss. I like Sabatini for a lot of different reasons in this one.
No, I agree. I've got Sabatini. I wish I got those odds at plus 105, but no, I do like Sabatini in this.
Both of us going with Pennsylvania's own Pat Sabatini. We can never side with the Canadians, or so it seems, but ultimately, love the card. Three title fights at the top. UFC 261. What a banger. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks all week. We got great content out there, including interviews with one big one with Rude Boy Randy Brown. We'll be talking about a little bit later on. So as I said, keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Straight up, we've got a clash of styles at middleweight. And listen, there's a lot of asterisks around the weight coming into this one. But we have Baby K, Carl Roberson, taking on All In Brendan Allen, the former LFA middleweight champ. And why do I bring up the weight? Well, for Brendan Allen, his last time out, it was a bit of a hodgepodge together type of fight where he took on Sean Strickland at a catch weight of 195 pounds. And he weighed in at 193.5. That's fair. For Carl Roberson, he took on Marvin Vettori. And listen, if you like Taylor Swift, well, I don't have a whole lot to say to you, but she had that song about bad blood, this and that. It was a bad blood fight between Carl Roberson and Marvin Vettori. And ultimately, Carl decided, hey, well, I'm going to weigh 190.5 pounds for that fight. Listen, Carl, can't be doing that. Can't be doing that. And can't be delivering performances like he did against Vettori. Because in that fight, well, the first takedown, who was it? Carl Roberson. Carl Roberson ended up getting the back of Vettori. It was like, holy smokes, what is this fantasy world that I've landed upon? And then Marvin snapped out of it and ultimately ended up winning the fight. He finishes Roberson in the first round. Now, I will say, Roberson doing the jump off the cage while he's caught in a bit of a headlock, that was pretty cool. For Brendan Allen, if we're talking total role reversal, go watch his fight against Sean Strickland. Brendan went, hey, Sean's a good striker, and so am I. And then he got totally outstruck by Sean Strickland. He got finished in the second round. So for the 5-on-in for both of these guys, Roberson 3-2, Allen 4-1. You look at it for Allen, he beats Aaron Jeffrey on Contender Series. He beats Kevin Holland, Tom Breeze, and Kyle Daukaus. I'd say, you know, the closest of those fights was probably, what, the Daukaus fight out of the four wins?
This fight is just the definition of a clash of styles, and that's the easiest way that we really can break this down, because at Carl Roberson, I know he's got a lot of submission wins, but let's just be honest. What's the first thing you think of when you think Carl Roberson? For me, it's glory. That's the first thing I think of. And you know how good his striking is. Carl Roberson, if MMA was conducted under kickboxing rules, he would be in the top five. And I'm very comfortable saying that. Carl Roberson as a pure striker is a handful to deal with because he does one thing that we get on a lot of fighters for not doing. He's great at keeping range with his strikes if that's what he chooses to do. Now, kind of plays into what you would say about the Vettori fight. Sometimes the fight IQ is not always there for Roberson, and he's not terrible at grappling. I would say he's a good offensive grappler, but in some of his defensive grappling, like we saw against Vettori, he can get overpowered by those bigger, stronger middleweights. Now, it is kind of interesting because when I think of Brennan Allen, he does a lot of what Marvin Vettori does well. He just doesn't strike nearly as well as Marvin Vettori. Marvin Vettori, he's got great top pressure, great ground and pound, but of course he is comfortable with his hands. With Brennan Allen, he's got the great ground and pound. He really makes guys pay for being underneath.
Tom Breeze.
He's got great submissions as well. We saw what he was able to do to a great fighter like Kevin Holland. But my problem with Brennan Allen is he doesn't throw strikes in volume, and he doesn't keep his hands up when he does throw in combination. And that's my big thing for Brennan Allen. I don't even think he's that bad of a striker, if I'm being honest. The problem is in his defense. And I know I always think of Luke Rockhold when I think of good strikers who are bad defensively, but Brennan Allen is slowly creeping into that category because for Allen, we know what he's so good at. And I know I talked about Sarah Kaufman when I'm thinking, hey, if they just knew what they were good at, they would have a lot more success than MMA. But for Brennan Allen, if he realized, hey, I'm great at wrestling, I'm really good at grappling, what if I just took guys down and tried to grapple them? That might be the path of least resistance. If Brennan Allen goes out there and gets the first takedown against Carl Roberson, I think I know how this fight's going to go for the total of the 15 minutes. It's going to be a lot of Brennan Allen in top control and Carl Roberson. It's probably going to be a lot of ground and pound. And if Carl Roberson can defend, I'll say the first, maybe even the second takedown attempt, he's going to absolutely piece Brennan Allen up on the feet. I'm really curious, though, do you think Roberson can have any success off of back against Brennan Allen, or do you think it is so cut and dry as when it's on the feet it will be for Roberson, and when it's on the mat Allen's the one in control?
We've seen Carl Roberson do poorly against grapplers. I mean, that's the thing. You look at the overall body of work. Again, you talked about the kickboxing, Jerome LeBanner, big time fight there. He got finished by Dusty Jacoby. Again, two knockdowns in a round, and that's all she wrote. But you look at the wins. Ryan Spann goes to take him down. Well, Ryan Spann has one kryptonite. It's that one spot on the Death Star. And if you can get it right, holy smokes, it's just elbows when he goes to take you down. It's happened a few times. It happened in that fight. He finishes Darren Stewart. And it was so weird that he submitted Darren Stewart, who's a halfway decent wrestler and grappler, if you want to see evidence of that. Maybe the Deron Wynn fight, I guess. He gets finished by Cesar Fajeya. That was a pay-per-view prelim headliner. That was really weird. Then he fights Jack Marshman at UFC 230, and I thought, okay, so he loses that fight, and then he fights on the main card of a pay-per-view in a fight that was kind of like, well, it happened.
He just pieced him up at range. That was the problem. And I do think you can parallel that Jack Marshman fight a little bit with the Brennan Allen fight. Is Marshman more hittable than Brennan Allen? I would say slightly, but the problem is Marshman has never had the wrestling to get to Roberson, and that was the problem. You could see he could get on the inside of Carl Roberson, but he couldn't actually get the fight to the mat. But I do think that you can pull a little bit from that Jack Marshman fight if you are in the camp of Brennan Allen.
Yeah, after that, goes up to 205, fights Glover Teixeira, gets finished predictably. Then he fights Wellington Turman. Also, really weird fight. That one at middleweight. He gets a split decision win. Okay, that's fine. He fights Roman Kopilov his second to last time out, and he beats him by third round rear naked. And the weirdest thing about that fight was, well, he beat him for the first two rounds. Totally outstruck him. They hype up Kopilov because he's a baby face. He's only 8-0 going into the fight. He was a big prospect. Big M1 global guy. Roberson looked great, takes him down, submits him at the end, awesome. And the one thing that he does really well, if the fight's up against the cage, Carl Roberson has this weird way of transitioning to get your back, and then he tries to get into a rear naked choke. He did it against Vettori, he ended up with a rear naked choke against Kopilov. He does have some other chokes on his record, Stewart's another one by rear naked. But against Vettori, that's the thing, another grappler, another good wrestler, and obviously we've seen what Vettori could do from June of last year until right now. The guy's in title contention. Whitaker probably overtook him, but they wouldn't have had Marvin Vettori sitting cage side if he wasn't somewhat in that conversation. That was just last weekend. He loses that fight. For me, I'm upset at Carl Roberson, or Roberson rather, for two reasons. One, that he lost that fight against Vettori. Two, because he was supposed to fight Dolce Champ twice at the end of last year, and twice we made videos for it, and twice Carl Roberson couldn't make it. Now, unfortunate, he got the vid. And then he had the symptoms of the vid, and now we're here. So Carl Roberson, again, Now he gets an opportunity against Brendan Allen. Brendan Allen, like I said, thought he was a striker against Sean Strickland, got pieced up. He beat Kyle Daukaus in a fight where Daukaus kind of took some of the tide near the end, but ultimately a Brendan Allen win. He finishes Tom Breeze in a fight where they struck a little bit, and Breeze started landing that, oh, I'm going to feed you the uppercut, going to feed you knuckle sandwich. Brendan Allen gets him to the ground, and near the end, the referee had seen enough, and he landed some elbows and some ground and pound and finished them. Holland, back and forth fight. Kevin Holland was an absolute dummy near the end and decided, I'm going to try and take down Brendan Allen.
But not really, okay.
And get submitted.
This is the problem. You bring up the fact that Carl Roberson took the back of Martin Vettori and how that was a showcase, if you will, of Roberson's grappling. Kevin Holland had Brendan Allen's back completely. Brendan Allen's still a good enough grappler to get Kevin Holland off his back with the choke in and then rear naked choke Kevin Holland. So for me, I just don't see any area where Roberson has more success, any other area than when both of his feet are planted on the mat and when he's at range. And that's really my problem for picking Roberson. I like Brendan Allen in this fight, and I do know that we saw what Sean Strickland was able to do to Allen on the feet, but I do think at least some of what the success that Sean Strickland had was because he's such a rangy striker, and he has great cardio. That's the thing about Sean Strickland. He can have such a great output with his cardio, and that's a really big problem for most fighters. With Roberson, I do worry a little bit with his output, and we even look back at the Wellington Turman fight. There's just not a lot happened. Sometimes Carl Roberson, for as good of a striker as he has, we're going to call this the Uriah Hall phenomenon, and I'm probably going to bring this up maybe a little bit later, but for as good of a striker he is, he's such a good counter-striker that sometimes he'll just wait and wait and wait and wait because he does want his opponent to really make that first step and then he can counter them. That's the one hesitancy I have about this fight. I could see this being a terribly boring split decision win for either guy. I really could. I could see this being a low output fight where Allen might secure a takedown but can't get a lot off on the mat, and Roberson might land a few jabs and good strikes in the feet but can't land a lot. So I'm ever so slightly going to pick Brendan Allen, but I do see this being one of those fights where it's either Carl Roberson the whole entire way or Brendan Allen the whole entire way.
I looked at so much tape on Carl Roberson coming into this one. I mean, he trains at a Killer B MMA. He also trains at a Nick Cantone MMA. Who's his main training partner? Well, if his main training partner tells us anything, it's Beeston 25-8 Corey Anderson, future Bellator light heavyweight champ after his performance over Dovletsan Yagshimuradov last week. But if Roberson was like, what, a tenth of the grappler that Corey Anderson is, maybe he'd have a lot more success. But for Roberson, a great left kick, a great left high kick. When he throws in combination, he does a great job. When he pumps out that jab, he does an awesome job. He is one of the premier strikers if he brings everything together. And then there's that threat of the takedown. And for Roberson, it's almost like, well, I'm all right at grappling, so I'm just going to be an offensive grappler. And that's where he gets caught into the tropes. That's where he can get caught into defensive submissions. And I agree with you. I look at the odds in this one. Brendan Allen, open to minus 205 favorite. He's now minus 136. For Roberson, open to plus 175. He's a plus 110. Now, the money's coming in on Roberson. I look at the picks on Tapology. 945 of them, 90% Allen, 69% submission. I'm kind of surprised now that we actually look at the Tapology votes, and they are a surprise. But the money's coming in on Roberson. The picks are with Allen. I do like Allen as long as he doesn't just assume that I'm a striker. Then he should be all right. When he did get cut in the Holland fight, it was an elbow when he had his face, he had the back of his head against the mat. Holland caught him clean. They cleaned it up between rounds. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was in the moment going back and watching it today. But I do like Allen in this fight. It is tricky because, again, it's a clash of styles. And if Roberson has improved quite a bit in his grappling abilities, 100% he can do it. Nick Cantone MMA, a super underrated gym there with the Mark Henrys of the world. But I do like the fight. It is a very interesting one.
So I'm sitting on a fence right now. And to my left, I see a 30-26 by Brendan Allen. And to my right, I see a Carl Roberson first-round knockout. And that's really as cut and dry as I see this fight. I really do think it is all one way or the other. But I am going to agree with you. I do think that the somewhat consistent attack of Brendan Allen and that forward pressure are going to give Carl Roberson troubles. And the problem with Roberson is that he does need to set to throw his really powerful techniques, to throw his kicks, to throw any of his powerful shots with his hands. When he does set his feet, that's going to be Brendan Allen's opportunity to really get in there and go for the takedown attempt. So I'm ever so slightly going to pick Brendan Allen, but I do think this fight is a very volatile one.
Both of us going with all in Brendan Allen to get the win, and it is a great fight. We have a great card as well. UFC 261 with three title fights up at the top. Make sure you check those out and all sorts of great content at FightNightPicks.com the entire week. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, Matt, let's get into it. If it's a fight you want, it's a fight you got. And we have Serbia's Stefan Sekulic taking on the body snatcher Dwight Grant, one of the most fun Instagram games out there. And this guy's playing around with nunchucks pre-fight. And for Dwight Grant, it really is a tale of two fights. You're either going to get absolute craziness and chaos, like his fight against, well, Bellator's Carlo Pedersoli, or his last time out where he got finished by Daniel Rodriguez, but Chris Tognoni just decided, hey, Dwight, you've got Daniel finished. I'm just going to let this one continue a little bit. And for Dwight Grant, unfortunately, he ended up getting finished himself. For Stefan Sekulic, this is a guy that you might not know a lot about. You can go back and watch the old fight tape from pre-UFC. You can go back and watch him fight, well, a name that a lot of people recognize in Ramzan Emiev, where he ended up losing a decision. That fight was 2.5 years ago, and that's the trouble. For Sekulic, he ended up testing positive for drostanolol and its metabolites, as well as a metabolite of methandienone. And listen, you don't want to get caught with that stuff. He took steroids, he got caught for it, and he paid with 2 years of his career. So now he gets another opportunity. He's only 29 years old at this point. For Dwight Grant, he's old AF, and I'm just kidding. But for welterweights, you don't often see fighters 36, almost 37 years old. But in terms of fight years, still very young. Plenty of quality wins on the record of Dwight Grant, and that's what you really like to see. For his opponent, Sekulic, again, if you don't know a lot about him, he is a Lucha Libre black belt. You might go, well, Craig, what is Lucha Libre? Well, let me tell you, it is a form of catch wrestling, also known as submission wrestling, and it really rivals BJJ. You can go out there and watch all sorts of BJJ versus Lucha Libre. Which one's better? Well, you don't often hear a Lucha Libre, and I'm explaining it to you, so there you go. But for Sekulic, you know he's going to employ that style of game plan. He is a half-decent striker. The trouble that he had against Ramzan Emiev, though, is a trouble that a lot of people have against Emiev, where he's a wet blanket, he's always going to bring the pressure, and in the third round, Ramzan decides I'm a kickboxer, and he runs out of a bit of its cardio, but in the fight against Sekulic, I mean, Sekulic just looked lost. He kind of did.
He just didn't look very good, and that's the weird thing about trying to compare him to Dwight Grant in this fight, because you bring it up. For Dwight Grant, watching Dwight Grant's kind of like buying a lottery ticket where you can either win $1 million or the lottery company comes to your house and just hits you. Because for Dwight Grant, you speak of it, the best version of Dwight Grant really is a fun fighter. Because let's just think about Dwight Grant as an idea. You've got a really tricky southpaw fighter with huge power, really good range to his strikes too, and he's got great head movement. I enjoy all of those things. But then you look at the worst version of him, which is the Alan Jobin version, which is that Zach Otto version, where it is a lot of that, I'm just going to stand around and not really do an awful lot. And it's weird, too, because normally when you have guys fight Alan Jobin, they might lose because he is such a technical striker, but it's not often that it results in a boring fight. Most of the time when Alan Jobin is paired up with Striker A, it's going to be a really fun one. But I got to be honest, for as excited as I was going into that fight, it left an awfully sour taste in my mouth because you just had a lot of guys standing at range and not really committing to their shots. And that's the weird thing for Grant. The best version of Dwight Grant, when he is committing to his shots, look at the Carlo Pedersoli fight. You don't often see left high kicks countered by overhand lefts. It doesn't happen that often. But the absolute bomb that Dwight Grant unloaded on Carlo Pedersoli
at the very end of the first round.
One of the most violent strikes you're ever going to see. Like, you really like full extension overhand rights? Try out my boy Dwight Grant, because what he did to Carlo Pedersoli, it really was a violent knockout. And when you see the power that he has in his hands, and you see him land on Daniel Rodriguez, you just assume after Rodriguez goes down, like, oh, hey, he's out of it. And let's be honest, if it was any other ref, he probably would have been out of it. So these are all great things for Dwight Grant. And the thing that, and I do really like what you had said. You talk about the age of Dwight Grant, but I don't really think you can just look at his age on paper and say how old Dwight Grant is. He is very young in MMA years, if you will. So I don't look at Dwight Grant as a 36-year-old welterweight. I look at him as still kind of a prospect working their way up the ranks. Because the good thing about Grant is, I do think that we do see him slightly improve every time he's in the cage. Now, he does need to be more consistent. That has been an issue for him, at least over the past couple of years. It'd be nice if we could see him in there more than just the 2 times a year. And I understand, we're in a pandemic. I can't get everything I want. But if Dwight Grant could get 2-3 in there every single year, I really do think we could get a fun contender one day. But for Sekulic, this will be interesting. I don't know if he'll be able to keep this fight at range for really any portion of this fight, because we know how dangerous Dwight Grant is. But for Sekulic, he's going to find success if he can close the distance. My issue is he's going to have to close that distance in a very smart way. You can't just rush forward against a guy like Dwight Grant. We've seen what happens. If he is on his game and hitting those counters, he's a very dangerous fighter to be in there with. So we'll be interested to see what game plan, Sekulic brings into this, because if he does try to strike at range, I think this will be a short night for Dwight Grant. But if he is able to extend Grant past that first round, we'll really be able to see a good version of what this fight should be.
And for Sekulic, you look at it, I mean, a guy, listen, now obviously I understand he doesn't actually train there, but if you go on Tapology, they have him listed as Family Fight Team. What do you imagine Family Fight Team is?
Just like a bunch of episodes of Family Guy and that's it. A dysfunctional household.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say like just a bunch of people that fight and they're still bloody and they go to bed and they wake up and they do it again. They bring their lunch pail and it's Family Fight Team. Just a weird place. But for Stefan Sekulic, if you actually look into it, it's a guy that trains primarily with Dusko Todorovic. So if you have anything in common, you just walk forward with your hands down, you get knocked out. I kid, but for Stefan Sekulic, I would expect him to employ some of that wrestling to try and really work Dwight Grant. Again, hope that you can weaponize your cardio. And we did see from Sekulic, even in the fight with Ameev, you can still kind of get it done a little bit later. I look at the regional fights. They are what they are. I mean, he got finished by David Zavada in 2015. He got finished by Adriano Balbi back in 2017. Leg injury. Stuff happens like that. Jason Jackson lost on, what, Contender Series because of a leg injury. It is what it is. You can still be a great fighter. So for me, if Sekulic can employ some of the wrestling, Grant used to be an AKA guy. He trained at Alliance for his last fight. And that's the other thing. You bring up the fact that he hasn't been super active. He's supposed to fight Jared Gooden. And then it fell out. He's supposed to fight Callum Bourne. I don't know where that guy went. Then he fought Daniel Rodriguez. Then he was supposed to fight back in December, but he got the vid. He was supposed to fight Li Jingliang. Oh. That fell out. And now he's fighting Stefan Sekulic. So if we have a look at the odds, I haven't had much of a chance to kind of get acquainted with them, but we've had some surprises on this card so far. So to me, I look at Dwight Grant. He opened a minus 300. He's a minus 244 right now. For Sekulic, opened a plus 250. He's now plus 193. And if we look at the Tapology votes, 862 of them, 89% Grant, with 73% by knockout. Maybe it's a fear that we're not taking the USADA unsanctioned drugs, steroids, if you will. But it's a weird one because, again, Grant, could he get taken down? Well, do you remember the fight against Zach Otto? Because I do. It was the most boring fight I've ever seen. To me, this is probably one of the most boring stylistic matchups on this card.
Oh, yeah, because the only way Sekulic can win this fight is by making it boring. And I know I say this for a lot of fights, but let's just look at the X's and O's solely. Dwight Grant is lethal at range. You can't stand far away from him, or he's going to land very powerful shots. Okay, we all have that established. We all agree. For Stefan Sekulic, here's the one good thing about that Ameev fight. At least one positive he can take moving forward. He got into good positions on Ameev. He just couldn't finish the takedowns on him. Because you know how good of a defensive grappler Ameev is. So Sekulic, if he can get it into similar positions up against the cage, I do expect him to be able to finish the takedown attempt against Dwight Grant. I just think Grant's going to be able to get back up to his feet consistently. And that's the thing. If Grant can keep up to his feet and keep this fight at range, I do think he'll be able to win this one. It should be an interesting fight, but I do agree with you. I don't think this is going to be a fight of the night contender, so I'll ever so slightly pick Dwight Grant, although I am very surprised to see what the Tapology votes are.
Yeah, and it is a really interesting one. I mean, for me, I wouldn't put it on my card. For Sekulic, you look at it, 6 submission wins, 3 wins by knockout. For Dwight Grant, 7 wins by knockout to 3 decision. These guys are definitely finishers, but again, the line's too steep for me on Grant right now. It's coming up on Sekulic. I'll see what I think by the end of the week, but for me right now, leaving it off my card, I do have a hard time with the pick, so I'm ever so slightly going with Dwight Grant as well. But let us know down in the comments section below who you're going with, because we've seen Jara Giustino, Jessica Penne. Yikes, did she really win that fight against Godinez? I don't think so, but we've seen fighters come back off very long layoffs and impress with wins lately, so maybe for that reason you like Sekulic. Maybe you see something in his game. Let us know what you see for this fight down below in the comments section. Love to hear from you. UFC 261, big time card. Yeah. 3 title fights. Keep it locked with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, Matt, let's get into it. Really interesting fight, Matt. At UFC 261, we have Rude Boy Randy Brown taking on Alex Cowboy Oliveira in a fight that was already scheduled to happen, but unfortunately fell out. It seemed like every other weekend these guys were going to fight. And listen, it goes back as far as February. And if you want to go back further than that, well, it didn't. It just goes back to February. But ultimately, very interesting clash between these two guys. Because for Randy Brown, and just as an aside, in my mind's eye, I think, well, he's a good wrestler. And he's a pretty good grappler. And he's a pretty good striker. And if he understood how to check leg kicks, he'd be a title contender. Rude boy Randy Brown. That good. This is a guy that came into the UFC way back in 2016, and by 2018, he didn't want to be just known as the Dana White's looking for a fight guy. So what happened in 2018? Well, he lost to Nico Price in one of the wildest finishes you've ever seen. He came back and finished Brian Barberena. He finished sad, tired Warley Alves, who's got a really big fight coming up. And then he lost to Vicente Luque in a fight. Well, you're probably going to lose to Vicente Luque. For Randy Brown, what do you like out of his game?
Just a lot, because you had kind of mentioned it. He is really well-rounded, but I would say he does have some strengths. I would say his wrestling would be the best part of his game. But is Randy Brown a bad striker? Well, no, not at all. Can he keep range as a striker? Yeah, he can. And does he have good jiu-jitsu? He did submit Warley Alves off of his back. Now, here's the one thing about that Warley Alves fight. Completely throw that out. And I know I just used that to say that Randy Brown's a good grappler. Warley Alves was not really fighting that night. I know that's weird, but please go back and watch that performance. Warley Alves just wasn't there. And I don't want to speculate on anything more than just that, but that was one of those performances that was just a little concerning from Warley Alves.
You gotta follow it up. Like, this is a guy that lost to Covington when he was riding high. This is a guy that just beat Munir Lazzez and looked
amazing.
He beat
Covington. That's the crazy thing about Warley Alves.
That's what I meant to say.
Exactly. Like, he has a guillotine win over Covington. He's got some great wins, but just in that performance, he just didn't seem all there. And that really is the best way I can describe it. Like, he was in these grappling sequences where he wouldn't even look at Randy Brown. He wouldn't look at his corner. He just seemed totally disinterested. So, that's the weird thing about Randy Brown's career. I know he's better than Brian Barberena, and that's the one thing. I hold Brian Barberena in very high regard. I think Brian Barberena is one of those fighters, and I'll kind of compare him to Nico Price. I know they're both in the same division, but both those guys can offer anybody, and I mean anybody, no matter what your ranking is, no matter where you are in the division, they're going to give you a hard fight. They are, and Randy Brown proved that against Brian Barberena, and Barberena proved it against Vicente Luque. That was, and I don't want to say you held it against Luque, but anytime we talk about Luque, you're always a little concerned. He didn't get dropped by Brian Barberena, but that's the thing about Barberena. He's dropped Leon Edwards, he's dropped Vicente Luque. If knockdowns counted for knockouts, Brian Barberena is one of the greatest to ever do it. But when Randy Brown beat Brian Barberena, at least in my mind, it proved to me that, wow, Randy Brown can be a future contender. Will he ever get to the title? Well, maybe not. But beating a guy like Brian Barberena does mean that you belong. And you not only belong, but you belong in that 25-15 range where it's going to take more than just one or two losses to get you out of the UFC. And the thing about Randy Brown in this fight is, I think he kind of does everything better than Alex Oliveira. Like, if this was the Alex Oliveira who maybe fought Yancy Medeiros back at 217, I might have a different opinion. If this was the Oliveira who fought Tim Means way back in the day, I might have a different opinion on him. But my issue with Alex Oliveira is that at this stage in his career, he just hasn't made a lot of improvements. It's the weird thing about Oliveira. It feels like in his first little run in the UFC, up until that Cowboy Cerrone fight, and even after that, up until I'd say around that Tim Means fight, he was that new product. He was that new breed. And I would say Alex Oliveira has a very unique style. It's not like Oliveira fights like a lot of other fighters. He's got that weird kind of lunging in style. He's a rangy striker. He's got weird power for being so thin, and he is just kind of good everywhere. But my issue with Oliveira is, I feel like he's one of those fighters where it's just enough film has been out there on him. He's fought so many guys. He's fought so many good fighters and so many fighters who can really offer you every different wrinkle of MMA that I just think people know what Alex Oliveira is going to do in that cage. And I think Randy Brown's a smart enough fighter that if he can go back and watch any of Alex Oliveira's old fights, I'm sure Randy Brown can replicate a game plan that can beat a guy like Alex Oliveira.
If you look at Alex Oliveira, I mean, you talked about it. He fought KJ Nunes the second fight out. What's KJ good at? Great striker, and he ends up finishing him. And then you look at the names. I mean, maybe there's not a lot of names that you recognize. Obviously, a loss to Donald Cerrone, one of Matt's favorite fighter that we haven't seen in what seems like forever. He beats Ill Will Brooks, has the weird fight against Tim Means, then beats Tim Means and beats Ryan LaFlair. Then he loses to Yancy Medeiros. And then we go from then. So let's look at it. He beats Carlos Condit in 2018. Carlos is in a weird time in 2018. Since then, he's looked good. But submitting Carlos Condit, that's a good win. You finish Carlo Pedersoli. Carlo just had a weird run in the UFC, straight up. Then he lost to Gunnar Nelson. Gross fight. Then he lost to Mike Perry. Kind of gross in terms of, well, you lost to Mike Perry. Then he loses to Nicholas Dalby in a fight that was, it was close,
kinda
I guess.
Close, yeah.
It was kind of close. He beats Max Griffin in a split decision. I thought Griffin won, but again, I've talked a lot more about Max Griffin recently than I have about Alex Oliveira. which is half true. Then he beats Peter Sabata, which we caught a lot of flack for taking Oliveira to beat Sabata, because what's Sabata good at? Boxing in close, he's a kind of tricky striker, he can work the body, and Alex Oliveira did that thing where I'm super long and I'm just going to dart in and out. And then he fought my favorite fighter from Kazakhstan. He fought Shavkat Rakhmonov. And listen, this is weird, but again, if you watch the Luke Thomas's of the world, well, Luke's really high on Shavkat Rakhmonov, and rightfully so. And I remember picking Shavkat Rakhmonov to beat Alex Oliveira, and people said, oh, that's silly. Well, Shavkat's very good, and we want to see him every weekend. So, he loses that fight by first-round guillotine. It's going to happen. Shavkat is very, very well-rounded, kind of like Randy Brown, but different fighters, but both well-rounded. Then he's booked to take on Randy Brown. Brown's out of the fight. Then he's booked to take on Ramazan Kurtamagomedov. And we got excited about that because he fought with PFL. He fought with multiple organizations. I believe we both had Kurtamagomedov to win. I also have Randy Brown to win. And originally I had Brown to beat Oliveira, and I still do in this fight. And it has zero to do with great interview that you should check out on our channel. But for Randy Brown, you listen to some of the improvements that he's made, and he's a guy that fight over fight. I don't focus on the bad. I focus on, hey, win or improve. And if I lose, I'm not going to dwell on it. I'm just going to go back into the gym and keep working on it. And he has a boxing background to mix in with good wrestling, to mix in with everything that he has. He trains out of Belmore Kickboxing. He's got the Gregor Gillespies of the world. And that's the funny thing. If you look at it, I made the thumbnail him and Gillespie. He looks like three weight classes, four or five weight classes, maybe even bigger than Gillespie. He's a huge guy for 170. I don't know how he makes the weight class because he's 6'3". He always has a reach advantage. And Oliveira is a tall, rangy guy, but Brown's going to have the size advantage in this fight. There's just so many things that I like out of Randy Brown. For Oliveira, what's he got to do to beat Brown? Maybe submit him? Like, I have a hard time.
For me, I really do think Oliveira's only way is by catching him with some kind of a shot on the feet and then maybe getting this fight to the mat. Maybe not submission. I would more likely go TKO just because Oliveira does have weird power. And that's the best way of describing it. Like you had mentioned too, the weird way he has of striking. In boxing, it's jump in, get carried out. But in MMA, you don't really have to worry about that. And you can mix in the grappling. So for Oliveira, if he can keep this rangy and maybe catch Brown with one of those weird straight shots and hurt him. But other than that, I agree with you. I think Brown's just a little bit better at everything. And the fact that I thought Randy Brown was just a wrestler for a little while, and then I thought he was just a striker. Now I see Randy Brown as that well-rounded MMA fighter who does have a little bit of everything in his toolbox. So I like Randy Brown quite a bit in this fight.
Randy Brown opened a minus 145 favorite. He's now minus 158 for Alex Oliveira. Open a plus 125. He's a plus 130. If we have a look at the Topology votes, it's a surprise for me and you. 936 of them, 70% Brown, 75% by decision, the 30% that have Oliveira, 55% by decision, 20% by submission, 22% by knockout, or thereabouts. Yeah, like I said, I like Randy Brown quite a bit more in this fight. Could Oliveira submit him? Sure. Could he outstrike him? Could he actually land a kick? Somebody out there's got to do it. Could Oliveira do it? Maybe. I just don't see it. I like Randy Brown here.
Yeah, I do too. I like Randy Brown quite a bit. I'm actually kind of surprised at where the odds are.
Both of us going with Rude Boy Randy Brown to get the win in this fight. Is Chet Hanks rooting for him? I don't know. Maybe. We'll see. But overall, a great fight. UFC 261. Three big-time bangers of title fights up at the top. Make sure you tune into the rest of the content for the week. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, Matt, let's get into it. Absolutely love our next fight at light heavyweight. We have Lionheart Anthony Smith, the former title challenger at 205 pounds. And not that long ago, taking on, Jimmy Crute. And a guy who has an absolute all-timer in his corner at all times in the knee pad king, Dan Kelly. And he's always got Judo Dan in his corner. And you love to see Judo Dan. You wanted him to get that extra fight in the UFC, but they put the kibosh to it. I always wish they did. I was a big Judo Dan guy, but for Jim Crute, you look at it, and he was undefeated until he took on Misha Serkinov. And what did we learn out of that fight? Well, that bigger wrestler grapplers can beat Jim Crute at his own game. And ultimately, it was one of the craziest submissions that you rarely ever see in MMA, Peruvian necktie. And hey, did Jim Crute have Misha in a bad spot at one point? Yeah, he did. And ultimately, he ended up getting finished. But you look at the UFC run, where even if we lump in Dana White's Contender Series, he finishes Chris Berchier. He finishes Paul Craig, ranked fighter. He beats Sam Alvey and finishes him in the first round. He beats Mikhail Olshaychuk and finishes him. He finishes Modestus Bukauskas. Now, Bukauskas Olshaychuk, who won? I don't know, we can disagree or agree until the cows come home. But for Jim Crute, he was supposed to take on Johnny Walker just a little while ago. Johnny decided we're doing too many pec flies and he tore his pec. And ultimately, Jim Crute gets, I would say, a bigger, better stepping stone in the former title challenger of Anthony Smith, a guy who, if we're talking about the five on in, 2 and 3 out of those last five fights, but the wins. Alexander Gustafsson over in Sweden and Devin Clark in the States, where he finished him in the first round.
And he looked great in both of those fights. And that's kind of the frustrating thing about Anthony Smith, because we've seen him have kind of these two different versions of him in these last so many fights. Because you look at him against Gustafsson, he's that confident striker. He's moving forward. And the thing about Anthony Smith is when he's moving forward and throwing combinations, there's not a lot of guys who weigh 205 pounds who can deal with that fighter. But then there's another version of Anthony Smith where he's just kind of waiting for his opponent. And if his opponent's a really good wrestler, like we saw against Alexander Rakic. Now, I think Rakic is one of the best 205ers. Yes, his performance against Thiago Santos might not have proven it, but a win is still a win. Can Jimmy Crute fight like Rakic did? I think he can, and that's a little concerning for Anthony Smith. So for me, this fight's going to be really entertaining and really exciting for this reason alone. What's Anthony Smith going to do if Jimmy Crute comes in and just wrestles? Because for Smith, we know he is that black belt jiu-jitsu on the ground. He's got great submissions. But one thing about Anthony Smith that I can't stand is that he will just kind of lay on his back sometimes. We talk about Luis Smolka, but Anthony Smith can be a bit of a victim of that, where if you do have really good takedowns offensively, you can make him be somewhat stall in his own guard, where he can throw up a lot of submissions. We know how good his elbows are. But if you can fatigue him and just get him on the mat, he's not the most high volume grappler, so you can get him sort of exhausted on the mat. And a guy like Jimmy Crute, I'm not saying just go and watch the Glover Teixeira fight and say, hey, there's my game plan, but Glover Teixeira was able to fatigue Anthony Smith, get him to the point where he can't defend my takedowns, and then once I get him on the mat, there's not going to be much there for him. If Jimmy Crute can follow that takedown, I think he'll have a lot of success. So for Smith, I really do think this fight just comes down to his takedown defense. If he can keep this fight at range, I think Anthony Smith is the much better striker at range, although I will say Jimmy Crute has some underrated power on the feet, but I think if Smith can keep this at range, use his front kicks, use his leg kicks, which he can use to great effect, and really keep this in one of those longer range fights where he is using his right straight, use against jab, I think Anthony Smith can go out there and win a 30-27, basically just behind his jab. But when I look at Jimmy Crute, and this is my last thing, I think he can go out there and just single leg, single leg, single leg. And if Anthony Smith's just giving up the takedown a lot, especially early on in this fight, I think Jimmy Crute can really exhaust Anthony Smith by defending those takedowns and take over as the fight progresses.
Smith's had a weird career, right? Because he came in from Strikeforce into the UFC in 2013, lost to Antonio Braga Neto. Where are you, Antonio? I've been calling for him. Where has he been? Come back to the UFC. But he had that one-off. He went back to the regional scene. He fought for Bellator. He came back to the UFC. And all of this while Jimmy Crute was a pre-pro MMA career, and during Smith's had that weird run, and everybody knows it, from 185 to 205. He went on the Legend Killing Tour, finished it with Volkan Oezdemir, and ended up with his title shot. For Crute, it's been those names that you like, but the weird thing is, you beat Paul Craig, that's cool. I wouldn't say legend, but, you know, he's beaten some good names in his own right. And then they give him some prospects after Sam Alvey. Serkinov, maybe not, but Olszewski Bukauskas, like, what?
No, I agree with
you. Why are we feeding them to him?
They're wins that you like, but you don't love. Because Jimmy Crute doesn't really have that statement win on his resume yet. And that's what's so exciting about this fight. Anthony Smith, and this is no disrespect to Jimmy Crute, but this is just to tell you the kind of guys Anthony Smith's fought. Other than Devin Clark, which was on extremely short notice, and they just threw that fight together.
3 rounds.
Yeah, exactly. Anthony Smith hasn't fought someone at Jimmy Crute's level in a little while. The majority of the guys we talked about who Anthony Smith has fought have been the Shoguns, have been the Rashad Evans. And yes, talent-wise, they might not have been where Jimmy Crute is right now, but at least as a name, those are big names to have on your resume. So this will be interesting to see what Jimmy Crute does with what I'll say is his first big step up in competition, because beating Misha Serkinov, Serkinov's a great fighter, but he's not the name that Anthony Smith is, and I do still think that Anthony Smith getting a win over him is getting a win over a main event worthy fighter, and I think that means a lot for a guy like Jimmy Crute, who is in desperate need of one of those statement wins.
If you look too far into the numbers, and if you just go UFC stats on this route. For Crute, he's only had 5 fights in the UFC. Craig, Alvey, Serkinov, Olszewski, Bukauskas. For Anthony Smith, John Jones, Gustafsson, Teixeira, Rakic, and Clark. Okay, totally different competition. But what you can do is you can compare some of the numbers. They flip-flop in strikes landed per minute and absorb. For Smith, whole body of work, 2.94 to 4.38 absorbed per minute. You hate to see it. For Crute, higher percentage of accuracy, higher percentage of defense, and 4.36 landed per minute to 2.31 absorb. And then you look at the takedowns, 4.33 per 15 minutes for Crute, 75% accuracy, 60% defense. But again, you got to consider Serkinov's taking him down, going after it, and he's attempting submissions, whereas Anthony Smith, and the number that I hate, I don't care that it's 28% accuracy, 51% takedown defense. Smith is going to, you know, accept some of these takedowns. For Crute, beats him in every statistical category, smaller sample size, lesser competition, different weight classes too, so on and so forth. But I still like all of those numbers for Crute.
Okay, the one thing I will say, and the numbers don't reflect this whatsoever, Anthony Smith is a better striker than Jimmy Crute. Like, when this fight's on his feet, I'm more concerned for Jimmy Crute than I would be for Anthony Smith, and I do think he can be the more damaging of the two strikers on the feet. But I see this fight going almost exactly how the Rakic fight went for Anthony Smith. I do see Jimmy Crute striking his way into that clinch and getting a lot of takedowns up against the cage. That's been something that Anthony Smith has struggled with really throughout his whole UFC career. And the one thing that Craig thought I was going to mention, but I might as well bring it up now. Anthony Smith does something that just frustrates me. And maybe his coaches tell him to do it, but I'll never understand why. He gets in this weird defensive shell where he will just back up to the cage, kind of put his hands up, and just sort of front kick out there. And I understand that's an effective way of keeping range with your opponent. But if you're just giving out your leg to a guy like Jimmy Crute, who can immediately grab that and use that as a way to get you down to the mat, I just see there being a lot of ways for Jimmy Crute to get this fight to where he needs to get it to win. I like Jimmy Crute in top position. And for all those reasons, I think Jimmy Crute's going to be able to get this one done.
Smith has a great tie game, so I can kind of get, you know, somebody that's also a striker, they close in, like in the Volkan-Uzdemir fight, we can land some
the
elbows.
Elvis Mostopchich fight?
We can do some nice things in close, Elvis. And then the other thing for Smith, he can kind of roll out of it, and then all of a sudden, you've got your opponent up against the cage, but, yeah, there's a lot of reasons why I like Jimmy Crute in this fight. I think it's just rinse and repeat. Can Smith submit him? I mean, look, he did submit Volkan-Uzdemir too, so there is that, but for Crute, you look at it, he opened a minus 155 favorite, he's a minus 200 right now. For Smith, open a plus 135, he's a plus 162. If we look at the Tapology votes, 1,080 of them, 74% Crute, 54% by knockout. 29% of the Smith fans, they've got him to win by submission, but I like Crute in this fight.
I do too. I just see him being the much more dominant physical force out of these two, and if anyone's getting the takedown, it will most definitely be Jimmy Crute on Anthony Smith, so I like Crute quite a bit.
Both of us going with Judo Dan's guy, Jimmy Crute, to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. Three title fights. It's stacked at the top. There's going to be fans in attendance. Plenty of pop and popcorn to be had here, and we're really looking forward to it. We got question mark kicks live 2 hours before the prelims on the YouTube channel. We also have the UFC 261 Fight Companion. You can join us, hang out, watch Anthony Smith fight Jimmy Crute, and see if we're absolute donkeys. We will see what happens, but ultimately, love the cards. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, as we always say, Matt.
Let's get into it.
This is the rematch you never knew you needed, and you might have never known that you had. We have Uriah Hall, primetime, not the smokes, taking on Chris Weidman, the All-American. And these guys fought at Ring of Combat 31 back in September of 2010. Ultimately, Chris Weidman got the first round finish. And Matt, I know you're going to talk about that fight, but since Uriah Hall had the weird career, because for Chris Weidman, he went on, he won every fight, he beat Anderson Silva twice, and everything else that happened with Chris Weidman's career. But for Uriah Hall, he loses to Weidman. Then he loses to future UFC vet Kostas Philippou. And then after that, beats Ong Lan Sung. Like, he beats some names that you know. Bubba McDaniel, Dylan Andrews. Ended up going to the finale of the Ultimate Fighter 17. And losing out to Kelvin Gastelum that you saw last weekend by split decision. But then he had a weird run. Like, he beats Thiago Santos. He beats Chris Lieben. He beats Oluwole Bamboje in one of the craziest finishes you're ever going to see. And he loses to good fighters. Whitaker, Brunson, Musasi. Then he beats Jocko, loses to Costa, beats Bavon Lewis. What a weird fight that one was. Beats Shoeface. Really close fight. Got taken down multiple times. And beat Anderson Silva in a fight where when he beat Anderson, I went, oh, okay. Well, that was the Uriah Hall that sometimes I wish I had, but not at all what I wanted at the start of his career, but I'll accept it because he's 36. And for Chris Weidman, well, he's lost five fights since he's fought professionally, and all five of them he's been knocked out or lost by TKO, and all five of those fights happened in a six-fight stretch that happened to include a finish over Kelvin Gastelum on Long Island. But you look at the losses, Rockhold, Romero, Musasi, Jacare, and Dominic Reyes. I don't know what one the most gross of them was. Probably, well, Romero, right?
There's been a lot of bad ones, though.
I would say the Romero one, because the Musasi one, we were playing the hand game a little bit. It was a weird one.
The Rockhold one was a late stoppage.
The Jacare one was kind of gross, too, because he was out, like, out. Like, he was in sleepy land.
He's been knocked out a lot, Craig.
He's been knocked out a lot. So, if you look at Weidman going into his last fight against Omari Akhmedov, a lot of people, ourselves included, had Akhmedov to win. You watch the fight. It was close. It was. Both guys got takedowns. Both guys got absolutely exhausted. But Chris Weidman didn't get as exhausted as Wolverine. Chris Weidman won that fight.
So the thing that Chris Weidman has to take from that Omari Akhmedov fight, and here's the thing. We didn't really glitz and glamour that win up because it really is hard to look good and beat Omari Akhmedov. He just is kind of that classic, I have good cardio, I'm a good wrestler kind of deal with it. And in that fight, it was just such a grueling pace for both guys because you knew how good both guys not only were getting the takedown themselves, but defending their opponent's takedown. And I do think that's why they were so tired at the end of it. Now, in this fight, I kind of think we can compare this fight to one that we did see earlier on in this card with Brendan Allen and Baby K. Carl Roberson. Just a lot of similarities between this. You have a long-range striker versus someone who likes to get it more on the inside and grapple. Now, Chris Weidman, much more comfortable with his hands than Brendan Allen. And Uriah Hall can throw more variety, I'd say, than Carl Roberson. But this is a really interesting fight because Chris Weidman, at least in this last little run, I don't know if I'm ready to say Chris Weidman has a bad chin or doesn't have a chin, but he definitely doesn't take damage as well as he used to. And I'll never forget, in that Jacare fight, one of the great Joe Rogan quotes is he goes, oh, well, finally, Chris Weidman, he's had enough sparring now in the striking that he's rolling with the shots. He knows what to do on the feet. And then Jacare knocks him out. And then Dominic Reyes knocks him out. My issue is that if Chris Weidman can't get the takedown, his striking just isn't that effective nowadays. And I know the highlights that we all see. He's got that great elbow, of course, on Mark Munoz, who basically just ran into it. He's got the nice left hook on Anderson Silva. But when you really think about the majority of the work that Chris Weidman gets done, it's that ground and pound position. It is that top control. Not a lot of Chris Weidman's highlights have come from him standing because his striking is very basic. He's not a bad striker. He just doesn't do anything that's really going to wow you. He's got a good jab. He's got a good left hook and right hand. But my issue with Chris Weidman, or at least in this stage of his career, is his striking speed isn't there. He's one of the slower strikers at middleweight. And that does concern me against a guy like Uriah Hall. Because Uriah Hall, and I know you're going to talk about it with the Pavon Lewis fight, he can lose every minute of a fight. He can look half asleep and basically look terrible for every second of a fight. But if you give him that one window of opportunity, he can still shut your lights out.
And for Uriah Hall, one of the better counter strikers in MMA, and I don't think that's a crazy thing to say. Did he drop Paulo Costa? I don't know. I kind of think he did, but and ultimately he loses the fight. But for Uriah Hall, he's in a lot of these fights. Like, you can never count him out, and that seems like a weird cliche to say. But for Chris Weidman, you can. I mean, against some of these strikers, he didn't do too well against, well, five of them in a short span. The other thing for Chris Weidman, he's not out of Sarah Longo or Longo Weidman MMA for this camp. He will have Ray Longo with him, and Ray Longo did make the trip down to Carolina, but he has been training at a Gym O. I actually like that for Chris Weidman, and this is the weird reason why. We've seen some fighters, Impa Kasanganai, had all he had at Gym O and decided to go to Sanford MMA, and all of a sudden he looks amazing against Sasha Plotnikov. But you look at the fighters that are at Gym O. Well, we had Joe Selecki. Had all the pieces, went to Gym O, really worked out. John Salter with Gym O and Chris Honeycutt, those are the wrestlers and grapplers that you really need to kind of accentuate what you're already good at. And obviously, Weidman knows exactly what he's good at, especially from his last fight. So for those reasons, I do like that move. And then pair up Ray Longo, and Matt Serra doesn't corner anymore, I guess. So Matt Serra not there, but pair up Ray Longo with all of that. I like those signs for Chris Weidman that he's at least comfortable enough to go, hey, maybe I need to make the move. Maybe we'll make this happen. This bout was originally scheduled for February. Weidman tested positive for COVID, so we're here now getting ready for it in April. But it is interesting because Hall's been out of Fortis for quite some time. Have we seen a huge evolution in his game? I wouldn't say so, but great cornering from Safe Sode.
Oh, without a doubt. Those are two, it's an athlete and coach that just really understand each other. It is a great duo, those two. The thing about Uriah Hall, and I will just touch on Weidman switching gyms, I'm going to push back just a little bit because I don't know if this is the fight you had to switch your gym for. Chris Weidman getting better at grappling won't make him a better grappler than Uriah Hall because he improved. He would have been better than Uriah Hall at grappling and wrestling no matter what just going into this fight. So for Chris Weidman, if anything, I would have liked to see him maybe go to a Sanford MMA, try to use a little bit more of your striking because for Weidman, The one area that's going to win or lose him this fight is his striking into the clinch. If we see Chris Weidman going out there trying to flip the jab and really try to stay on the feet with Uriah Hall, I'm telling you right now, Uriah Hall's going to time some lazy shot at Chris Weidman and absolutely counter the bejesus out of him. Go back to the Antonio Carlos Jr. fight. That's the one that I think about a lot when I try to parallel this fight with other ones that Uriah Hall's had, because Hall on the mat, did he give up takedowns? Yeah, he did, but the great thing about Uriah Hall was he did work his way back up to his feet against a very accredited jiu-jitsu ace, and that was a great thing to see from Hall. And the other thing was, I did see a sense of urgency in that fight. It was weird because it was in that fight and it wasn't in the Anderson Silva fight, because I just thought Uriah Hall looked really good against Carlos Jr. I just thought he was against a tough stylistic matchup for himself, a guy who can close that distance and can make it somewhat of a boring fight, if you will. What Uriah Hall was really able to do well was, again, make him pay for closing that distance. The one, it's a beautiful right-hand counter that he's able to land on Carlos Jr. He steps to the outside and absolutely cracks him and floors him with that shot. If he hits Chris Weidman with that same punch, he's going to put him to sleep. I just don't think Chris Weidman has that level of durability at this stage of his career. And we were kind of joking about earlier about this fight, but I could see this being one of those weird fights where Chris Weidman shoots for a takedown. Hall could catch him with one of those weird shots, because I do think Hall has this kind of power where it might look like one of those Francis Cain Velasquez fights where Cain goes for the takedown up against the cage, gets Hall hit with a shot that you might not be able to, that isn't overly apparent at the moment, and then you figure out, oh, Uriah Hall caught him with an uppercut or something on the way in. I'm just worried about the entries from Chris Weidman. I understand if you look at the X's and O's of this fight, a lot is pointing towards a Chris Weidman victory, but I don't know. There's just something in the back of my mind that says Uriah Hall is going to catch him with a counter shot.
There's going to be people in the comments section saying, Matt's sleeping on Chris Weidman.
I could be.
Maybe you are. I don't know. The rematch, I mean, Weidman was able to get a first-round finish win over Hall the first time out 10.5 years ago. So, Matt, let's focus on the odds for this one. Hall opened a minus 135. Now the odds are at par. About a minus 111 for each guy. For Weidman, like I said, he's there now. He opened a plus 115. If we look at the Tapology votes, 1,087 of them, 62% Hall, 82% by knockout. For the 38% that have Weidman, 77% by decision. So, does Chris Weidman win by decision and tire the heck out of Uriah Hall, or does Uriah Hall time a shot, time a takedown, and finish Weidman? I mean, that's pretty much the question.
I mean, I know you dislike it when I do this, but I'll do it anyways. Everything tells me Chris Weidman should win this fight, but I'm going to pick Uriah Hall. I do think Hall's going to be able to catch him with one of those counter shots. And if you look at Weidman, I didn't love his cardio in that Akhmedov fight, and I understand the work rate was very high, but if you're fighting someone like Uriah Hall, his footwork's so good on the outside that you are going to be following him a lot, and you're going to also just naturally have an elevated work rate just due to his movement. And for Weidman, I don't love his ability to close the distance. I think he can get in on the legs of Uriah Hall. I have no doubt he's going to get a takedown in this fight, but for me, I do think Hall can catch him on the way inside. And yes, maybe the numbers point towards Chris Weidman, but I do like the power of Uriah Hall, and I do think his sense of timing, yes, he might get taken down in that first fight and he might get controlled. Yes, it might happen in the second round too, but the one good thing about Uriah Hall is, if you go back to the Geir Mousasi fights, Geir Mousasi is a wicked grappler and he's really good on top. He took down Uriah Hall, had success, but the thing about Hall was he was able to get back up to his feet. I'm gonna ever so slightly edge Uriah Hall, but I do think this is a very, very fun fight on our main card.
Couple of old 36-year-olds, I'm going with Uriah Hall as well. I mean, I have such a hard time with this one. Am I counting Chris Weidman out? No, because again, it's a really close one. I wouldn't throw it on my card because again, they're pick'em odds. Weidman wins, decision. Hall wins, probably going to be a knockout. I mean, it's cut and dry. It's not just Tapology. It's just, that's just the way it is, really.
I am interested in both guys moving forward, though, because right now there is this weird logjam at middleweight where Robert Whittaker is probably the number one contender. I think everyone can agree on that. But you've got Martin Vettori, who probably should be the number one contender, but still needs a dance partner. You've got Till, who's been hurt, Kosu, who's been out. Just a really interesting weight class at 185.
Really interesting, and I can't wait for this fight. The rematch, years and years. And years in the making, Matt. I'm going with Uriah Hall. You are as well. Love this card. And it is time. We have three title fights ahead, so you're not going to want to miss any of those previews. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Hey, you. Yeah, you. Gut Bush? You definitely do if you haven't tried the best products from our sponsor today. It's, of course, Manscaped. After using these life-changing products, listen, you're going to want to join a ball sack beauty contest. I'm looking out for you too, because I also have an exclusive 20% off discount code. Use the code FMP at manscaped.com. Matt, we've all been there before. Listen, you're a shower shaver, and I talk about it week in and week out. And I still am. I haven't changed my plan. I haven't just started shaving in the backyard, shaving in the sink.
I'm sure your neighbors appreciate it.
Still a shower guy. And for me, it's Lawnmower 3.0. The LED light that's there, you can hear it. That's great stuff. And the big bonus is the light. I mean, listen, it's got a ceramic blade. You're not going to nick your nuts, this and that. But if I can actually see what I'm doing, I'm going to end up with less problems. And we've all been there. I bought that cheap kind of set that you can buy at the big box store. And it gets rusty. It gets gross. You forget to oil it. Like, there's a lot of issues that can arise. And I don't want tetanus. So, yeah, I've been there before with the cheap stuff. This is waterproof. You can use it in the shower. It's not a big deal. They're dedicated to helping you level up your full body grooming game with the Perfect Package 3.0. And if you go with it, you get the shit. And who doesn't need a nice toiletry bag? Listen,
it's nice.
The world's going to eventually open up. And I am the type that really likes to have a nice toiletry bag. The other thing, this used to be a talking point for these folks, but the charging stand. And listen, we're still doing Zoom stuff. You're still on Skype. You're still on Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp. I don't know, whatever else your Overeem used to use. And listen, you're parading yourself around your house. If you've got that on your bathroom, I don't know, if you got it hanging out.
Your fireplace even.
Your fireplace. It's a good look. A nice charging stand can make a big difference. It's definitely the best trimmer that you can get to help trim and groom the hedges. And it also features, like I said, a cutting-edge ceramic blade to help reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced skin-safe technology, which was pioneered by Manscaped. When you trim the hedges, the tree stands taller. If you're a grower, not a shower, that's very important.
If you want rusty nuts, go ahead, click away. That's fine with us. You don't have to. But if you want the best male grooming tool out there, try Manscaped out.
Matt, they also have in the Perfect Package the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's like a salve. I tell you every week, slap that stuff on there. It works great. They also have the Crop Reviver. Now, this is starting to get a little bit less.
Might need
a little bit more, but it's a nice little spritz. I won't spritz it out there today, but you just toss that stuff on your nuts. It's good stuff as well. They also have the Weed Whacker in the package. You see me do this every week, but I'll trim my nose here on camera.
How fast does it grow?
It grows pretty fast. It's always grown pretty fast. And if you do get the Perfect Package, it also comes with the Shed Travel Bag as well as the patented high-performance reduced chafing Manscaped boxers. And if you head over to their website as well, they also have the greatest refined cologne. It's that great Manscaped scent. It's good stuff there, too. So get 20% off and free shipping using the code FNP at manscaped.com. Do yourself a favor and always use the right tools for your bush trimming experience. Matt, let's keep it going with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
And welcome back with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. To my left, your right, Matt Allen on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And we could not be more excited for the first of three title fights. We have the women's flyweight strap on the line between Bullet Valentina Shevchenko and Jessica Andrade, the former strawweight champ, the former UFC bantamweight, who's beaten such a high level of competition. That's the thing. For Jessica Andrade, we talk about it at 135 pounds. And you may have thought she was even undersized, possibly at 25, maybe even at 115, because she's so short. But such a powerful athlete. And as far as all of the metrics and numbers are concerned, a much higher rate in a lot of those statistical categories than her opponent, the longtime champ at flyweight, Valentina Shevchenko. But just to go through some of those names, for Andrade, she fought Jennifer Maia, future title challenger. She fought Liz Carmouche, future title challenger. Beat Dr. Rosie Sexton. Beat Raquel Pennington, future title challenger. Beat Larissa Pacheco, future PFL title challenger. And the list goes on and on. But it has been such a very high level of competition for Andrade. And the craziest thing is, she's not even 30 years old. It's insane to think of how long Andrade has been in the UFC. She debuted way, way back when at UFC on Fox 8 in 2013 against Liz Carmouche and actually got finished by the now Bellator flyweight. And for Valentina Shevchenko, the same can be said as far as the level of competition, whether at 35 or 25. You look at it, her debut in the UFC, she fights Sarah Kaufman, and then her next time out, we're talking Amanda Nunes at UFC 196. One of the biggest cards of all time. And it's crazy to see how her career has played out because a lot of people think highly or so highly of those Nunes fights that you almost kind of gloss over this championship run that she's had at 25. And while the names haven't been spectacular. I mean, again, Aya Carmouche Chookagian, not the greatest. Maya, she lost a round, but she has looked impressive in her own respects in different areas of the fight. The other thing for Shevchenko, and you'll see it by the graphic that pops up, she's fought in some of the most obscure hole-in-the-wall gyms while she's been a champion, and we can attest to it. When she was getting ready for Joanna Jędrzejczyk, UFC 231, back in December of 2018, she trained at another hole-in-the-wall in Brunswick, Maine, and rented like a cabin on a lake, just getting ready for the fight, training with no uncertain training partners, with her average everyday coach and her sister, Antonina. And she looked great in that fight.
I'm more excited for this fight than I am any other one in the card. There you go. I'm more excited for this than the co-main or the main event, because I truly believe Jessica Andrade is the only woman at this division who even has a small chance of beating Valentina Shevchenko. And I do think it's going to require someone with the skills of Andrade to really go up against a champion like Shevchenko, because other than that one Jennifer Maia fight, and really other than that one round in the Jennifer Maia fight, we haven't even seen Shevchenko tested at 125. Now, I will bring up the one fight where we didn't see her tested a little bit. Joanna Jędrzejczyk didn't do that bad against Valentina Shevchenko. Everyone has this narrative of, oh, she moved up in weight class and then Shevchenko dominated her. Not really. And Joanna lands a lot of clean shots in that fight. It's just, I never thought that Joanna really got her fair shake when people bring up the amount of trouble, I guess, Shevchenko has had in some of her title defenses, because I do think Jędrzejczyk had at least some level of success. Now, Jessica Eye didn't do anything good in that fight whatsoever. Liz Carmouche, that fight was terrible. Let's just call it what it is. But that was just one of those low work rate fights. She absolutely dominated Shevchenko, though. And the Jennifer Maia fight was interesting. And I'd love to get your take on this, too, because I think Valentina Shevchenko, she might be falling into what I'm going to now coin as a Chris Cyborg rut, where you've fought so many people who aren't even close to your level. Because let's be honest, a lot of people like to say that, oh, this big underdog has a chance. I didn't see a single person say Jessica Eye could beat Valentina. I didn't see a single person say Caitlin Chookagian or Jennifer Maia could. But now she's starting to find herself, or at least in her last one, in fights harder than she at least thought they would have been. Do you think when she goes in against Jessica Andrade, there's at least a little bit of a chance where she's finally going to get in there with what I'm going to consider a world-class opponent, and she's going to be like, damn, I haven't been in here with someone like this in a little while. Will it take her a little bit to get used to another world-class opponent?
I look at the odds, so I'm going to play into this. For the Jessica Eye fight, Shevchenko was roughly a minus 1,400 favorite. Carmouche, minus 1,100. Caitlin Chookagian, minus 1,200. Jennifer Maia, minus 1,825. And then for Andrade, minus 400.
It's wild, because if there was any other champion who had this easy of a path after they got the belt, we would not be talking about them as one of the best pair-for-pair fighters in the sport. And I know I sound like a Shevchenko hater right now, I just don't think that her run at 125 has been all that spectacular. Now, if you put a name on your resume like a Jessica Andrade, I'm going to change my opinion really fast. I just think that we are finally dealing with someone who can beat Shevchenko, and we haven't even seen her in the cage with someone who has a chance against her since Joanna or Amanda Nunes, depending on how you looked at them.
I mean, you look at the losses. So the Carmouche loss was the cut that ended the fight. All right, stuff like that happens. We throw that one out. It says KO, TKO, but now you know. The two decision wins are weird because Nunes in the first fight, did she win it? Yeah. The second fight, was it closer? I don't know. They were both pretty close fights. But you like to see that out of Shevchenko, and you could kind of project, okay, well, if she does make the move to 25, future champ for a very long time. For Andrade, though, you look at the run at 15. So let's forget about 135 and let's focus on 115 pounds. She beats Jessica Penne.
Finishes her.
Jessica, where you at? Picking up wins over Lupi Godinez that you didn't really win. Then she beats Joanne Calderwood.
Finishes her.
Then she beats Angela Hill.
One of the low-key greatest women's MMA fights of all time. I highly recommend going back and watching it.
Fights Joanna Jędrzejczyk at UFC 211. Loses by decision. All right, so do we give up? Do we move up to 25? No, we pick up the pieces. And she comes back out 4 months later and fights Claudia Gadelha. And wins.
Destroys her.
Then she beats Tisha Torres. Right. Then she beats Karolina Kovalkiewicz. And that was gross.
Oh,
that was just
goodness.
Straight up gross. Then she beats Rose Namajunas. Was it illegal? Rose will have you believe it. Some people will as well. But she does beat her, finishes her, gets the belt. Rose was coming off of the fights against Joanna that were absolutely insane. And of course, if you're going to tune in for the next video, which you should, we will talk about them in more detail. But she beats Rose Namajunas handily. And then it's a one and done. She loses to Zhang Wei Li. It's about 3 months later. It's in China. It was a weird one. She didn't look all that great. She looked kind of flat. And listen, it was fun while it lasted, but Zhang Weili gets the win. Then she loses to Rose Namajunas by split decision. I know you'll talk about it a little bit more, but she loses by split decision. That was UFC 251, Masvidal Usman. Make sure you stick around for the second part of that. We'll be talking about it later on. So then she moves up to 125, and she fights Caitlin Chookagian. Listen, the late DMX, probably a big Caitlin Chookagian fan. She always comes out. She reps it. She's the blonde fighter. But in that fight, Andrade hit her to the body. And I've never seen somebody, and every now and again you see somebody give up or wilt under the pressure in a cage. But when she hits Chookagian, Chookagian runs the other way. She hit her so hard with that one.
I don't like the word give up. I gotta be honest. When you get hit to the body, there's just a delayed reaction. Like, you see that with a lot of fighters. You don't really know what to do because you have no more air in your lungs. So for Andrade, I really think her key to this fight, and it will be interesting because I doubt she's just going to be able to out-muscle Valentina Shevchenko the way that we were able to see her do it at 115. Because when I think of the best wrestling of Jessica Andrade, she's not like a Tatiana Suarez who, oh, I'm so technical with my single and double legs. She straight up picks people up over her head and slams them down. That is her nickname. It is Pile Driver in Portuguese, which kind of tells you all you need to know about Jessica Andrade. I think if she can make her way to the inside and make this a very ugly fight and land good shots on Shevchenko, the ball is going to be in Shevchenko's court to then respond. And for Shevchenko, again, I just haven't seen her face any resistance. And when you do that 5-on-in, I know Shevchenko, it might be more impressive because it's not like she's 3-2, but her wins aren't that impressive. Like, beating Jessica Eye, could Jessica Andrade beat Jessica Eye at 125? I almost guarantee you she could. Could she beat Caitlin Chookagian? Well, we already saw it, and yeah, she did. And then when you talk about the second Rose Namajunas fight, she looked terrible in the first Rose fight, if we're being honest. Andrade did. Slams her on her head. In the second one, she eats a lot of shots at range, but when she does work it in close and kind of fight in a John Lineker-esque way, she absolutely beats and batters Rose Namajunas on the inside. So I think if Andrade can make this a boxing fight, don't let Shevchenko just be on the outside and really take her pictures and set up her counter. I do think Andrade can at least make this an ugly enough fight to win a round or two. But what I am concerned about is that Shevchenko, A, her gas tank is just phenomenal. She doesn't get tired at all in fights. So if Andrade is having success, I do think it's going to cap out at a certain point. And I do think all of her success is going to be coming from her energy and not from her technique. And that's where I do have to favor Valentina Shevchenko. I do favor her at-range attacks, and I do think the predictable attack of Jessica Andrade, as powerful as it might be, it will be predictable after a certain point. We saw what Shevchenko was able to do to Jessica Eye after she figured out, oh, Eye's dropping her hands every time I kick. She was able to set one up to the head, and I do think Shevchenko will be able to set up a big counter shot as this fight progresses.
For Shevchenko, even if you want to focus on the Maya fight and say, okay, she did lose a round, 100%, she did the second round, she got, you know, controlled for, what, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of it. She controlled the first round for 4 minutes and 29 seconds, so the second round is Maya, and then it's like, oh boy, like, we laid down a lot of dope, -1825. Did we make a mistake? Yeah, well, ultimately you didn't, but at the time, yeah, you did. And then in the second round, Shevchenko, third round Shevchenko, or sorry, third, fourth, and fifth, it's all Shevchenko, and it was just a blip in the radar in that fight. But there's opportunities to beat Shevchenko if you close the distance, if you work the takedown. Can somebody like Andrade keep it up over 5 rounds? Probably not. You'd almost want her to get a finish, would you not?
Really, the only way I see Andrade winning this fight is by clipping Shevchenko a la Amanda Nunes Cyborg, because I do think it is a similar fight, whereas you have Andrade who, yeah, she might have lost to the higher level of competition, but she's always been fighting the best of the best of the best. Like, Jessica Andrade, it doesn't matter what weight you are, how tall you are, like, Andrade has fought the best fighters out there, and I don't know, Connor was the first fighter to have 3 TKO wins. I don't know if beating the number one contender in 3 weight classes deserves an award, but Andrade has done that, and that's a very impressive task. So, again, like I said, if anybody can do it at 125, it will be Jessica Andrade. And if she can do it, I see it by TKO, but I like Shevchenko in the end.
We talked about the odds for this one earlier on, but Shevchenko opened a -335 favorite. She's now a -407 or thereabouts on best fight odds. For Andrade, she opened a +275. She's now +309. Now comes the part that we love. We haven't seen the Tapology votes, so it's a surprise to everybody. 1,099 of them. 93% Shevchenko. 51% by decision and 39% by knockout. For the slim margin, the 7% that I have on Andrade, 65% by knockout. It's another one. I'd leave it off my card because I do. Does Jessica Andrade win this fight in certain respects? I think she can. I really do think that she can. Again, the mix of power and the takedown ability, you saw it from Maya. Maya was able to take her down. And Maya is a little bit more of a tentative striker. That's a huge thing. I mean, Maya can strike. Is she as technical as some of the other strikers at 125? Maybe not. Is she as powerful as like an Andrade? No. She can strike, but her biggest weapon is if she can really work the takedowns, get the submissions, you're looking at Jennifer Maia. For Jessica Andrade, it's the power, it's the takedowns, it's the, what, position. It's usually some more position over submission into the ground and pound, but Andrade's got a shot.
This is the thing. Again, I'm the biggest Jessica Andrade, like, hey, she can win this fight, but even I'm struggling to find areas where she's going to have success. Unless she is able to catch Shevchenko with a big shot early on and then hurt her enough to where she can finish her on the feet. My problem is, you bring up the takedown. All of Andrade's takedowns are slams, and I don't see a single area where Jessica Andrade picks up Valentina Shevchenko and slams her over her head. I think that the reason Maia has success with her takedowns is she can do trip takedowns, she can do single or double legs, and do more traditional takedowns, which really just take advantage of your opponent's body weight, whereas Andrade has to pick up her opponent and slam them on their head. I just don't see it for Andrade. She might be able to catch her with a big shot, but I do see Shevchenko just being the more accurate and the more having the more volume out of these two strikers. I think Shevchenko will be able to win a decision, but I don't think this fight's going to be this massive one-sided fight for Valentina, and I do think Andrade will have at least some moments where she has success.
The really funny thing out of this, when you compare these two fighters, and again, you look at all the numbers for Andrade, her average fight time in the UFC, 10 minutes and 12 seconds. They're 15-minute fights, and they're usually ending two-thirds of the way through or thereabouts. For Shevchenko, 17 minutes and 18 seconds. A true title fighter that usually goes longer into her fights. I like Shevchenko, and I wouldn't say ever so slightly, but again, the odds for me are a little crazy, and I won't have her on my card. But again, championship pedigree for both of these women. Shevchenko, as far as the work rate's concerned, fairly close. But again, I like the striking defense. I like the bobbing and weaving and the little micro movements and the kicks that she just kind of throws out there for fun. And the longer the fight goes, it definitely favors a champion in this circumstance. So for those reasons, I will go with Valentina Shevchenko, who, by the way, and you've seen it in the graphic, is representing Smiley's MMA because she trains at the weirdest gyms in the world.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I've got Shevchenko probably by decision. I doubt she's able to finish the durable Andrade, but this should be a phenomenal fight at women's 125.
Both of us going with the champion, the and still Valentina Shevchenko. Let us know down below in the comment section who you're going with in this fight. Do you think we're a couple of donkeys? Are you going with Andrade in this one? Or maybe you're going with Shevchenko. We get two more great title fights at the top. Zhang Weili taking on Rose Namajunas. And in the main event, the rematch, we have Kamaru Usman taking on Jorge Masvidal. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight in our co-main event of UFC 261. We have the second title defense of China's Zhang Weili. And listen, it has been an absolute buzzsaw of a run in the UFC. You look at her overall body of work, you lose that early on in your career and go on an absolute heater. It's insane what Zhang Weili has done. And also featured on this card, we have three debuting fighters from China in Liang Na, who fights, you know, in the same weight class at 115. We also have Ar Chilong, and we have Rong Zhu as well. But for Zhang Weili in taking on Rose Namajunas, you look at the five fights coming into this. Michelle Waterson to ultimately end up in a title fight against Joanna Jędrzejczyk 3 years and 4 months ago, UFC 217. Wow. It has been forever. Then she picks up another win over Joanna. She ends up losing to Jessica Andrade. Weird circumstances. Beats her in the rematch by split decision. Odd fight, especially closer to the end than it was to the start. But really, we get a fight like this and you go, well, for Zhang Weili, I mean, she comes into this one, she's almost 32, she's been off for a full year since the absolute war that was the fight of the year against Joanna Jędrzejczyk, 21-1 her overall record. For Rose Namajunas, she's been around since the season of The Ultimate Fighter that really brought in the strawweights. She's 28, so she's still young, and she only has 13 pro fights in her career. It's just weird the two circumstances that both these women have had, the level of competition they face, and where they're at in their careers facing each other here in a fresh matchup up at the top.
It feels like Rose Namajunas has been involved with more title fights than Brandi Couture, because it does feel like every single time she is in a fight, it feels like a belt's on the line, and that just really tells you what kind of a fighter you're dealing with when you do talk about Rose Namajunas. She is very well-rounded, but the fact that she was A, able to knock out the striker in Joanna Jędrzejczyk, and then defend the people who said it was a fluke win, go on and defend her title in, again, what probably was the greatest MMA fight in the division of all time until Wei Li and Joanna ended up taking that. But it just has been a really weird career for Rose Namajunas, because go back through some of her losses. We've seen her get out-wrestled by Carla Esparza. We saw her get out-struck at range by Karolina Kowalkiewicz. And we've seen her get, well, basically just slammed on her head by Jessica Andrade. Now, the one thing about Rose Namajunas is that if you beat her by one way, it's not going to happen again that same way. Very cerebral fighter and a very smart fighter who makes adjustments inside the cage. We saw that against Michelle Waterson even. Now, that fight, I feel terrible for Michelle Waterson. She basically got head kicked and rear naked choked in that fight. But you saw what Rose Namajunas was really capable of. And I at least feel like that was the first fight I looked at Rose Namajunas and thought, wow, she could at least fight for the title one day. I didn't think the UFC was going to immediately give her the title shot, which they ultimately did, and she made good on it. But that was a fight where I was like, okay, she's finally incorporated her jiu-jitsu along with her striking. And then you see what she was able to do against Joanna in those two fights. Rose Namajunas is a problem to deal with. And it will be really interesting to see what new wrinkles she brings to Wei Li. Because with Wei Li, you know how good of a striker she is on the outside. And the neat thing about Wei Li, too, is we know how good her ground game is. Everyone talks about how great her striking is, how explosive, how accurate her strikes are. But her on either top position or off her back is an absolute handful to deal with. And that's why I'm so excited for this fight. I don't care where it takes place. They could be up against the cage, in open space, or on the mat. It's going to be exciting no matter where this fight takes place.
And we've seen a lot of different wrinkles in Zhang Weili's game. You bring that up. She averages over a takedown per 15 minutes. Her takedown accuracy might not be the best. But again, if you're going to strike to clinch, if you're going to work and tire your opponent, she's 100% takedown defense so far. And for Namajunas, you give one to take one, 53% accuracy, 50% of them are defended. The higher work rate going the way of the champ, good accuracy on both of their respective sides. Again, you get different looks out of Zhang Wei Li, whether it's from southpaw or from orthodox. Probably going to get a little bit more orthodox out of Rose Namajunas, somebody who's fought at elevation in Colorado for a very long time. Listen, when we look at a fight like this with Rose Namajunas, it is weird because, again, we talk about Zhang Wei Li. She's been out for a year. Rose has fought more recently. It was a split decision fight over Jessica Andrade, where Rose looked really good early, and Jessica looked a little better later on. So it's an odd one. I mean, again, it's kind of difficult at the top half of this division. Who do you give a title shot to? Do you go with, again, let's say this fight wasn't ever booked. So do you go with the hot hand of Mackenzie Dern? Like, there's very few fighters you can really go with that have been active recently. Suarez has been out forever. She needs to get a win. Nina Ansarov just lost. Nina Nunes, rather. And then you look at this, it's a fresh matchup that we haven't seen before. So you give Zhang Wei Li to Rose Namajunas and vice versa. For Zhang Wei Li, she made her debut just over 2.5 years ago, beat Danielle Taylor. You want to see that win. Submits Jag, just a pioneer of the sport. She beats Tisha Torres, she beats Jessica Andrade and finishes her to win the belt. And then she fights Joanna Jędrzejczyk in an all-timer. And listen, you can make an argument both ways. I know I had scored it for Zhang Wei Li. Going back and watching it, I've still scored it for Zhang Wei Li. But again, you can make the case. Strength of schedule probably sides with Namajunas. It definitely sides with Namajunas if you really go through it. She's fought the highest level competition basically since she's turned pro, really. And it's been a long career, albeit again, she's young and she has less fights. So it is a tricky one because, like you said, for Namajunas, always brings a different kind of aspect into every fight. What do you almost expect as a game plan against somebody like Zhang Weili, having that Trevor Whitman connection coming into this?
So for Namajunas, that really is the question, because I kind of know what I'm going to get out of Weili in this fight. I'm going to get the forward pressure. I'm going to get her throwing in combinations. And I think she is quite a bit faster than Namajunas. That's one thing that you should really watch out for, because whoever's landing first is going to be the one landing more often throughout this fight. I don't think either one has cardio issues, although, like you had mentioned, in the Andrade fight, at least in the third round, she did start to fade. Now, she did have a pretty good output in those first two rounds. And I think if she did kind of at least manage her energy a little bit better, she would have been able to fight a little bit stronger in the third round. But for Rose, I don't really know what she's going to do on the outside consistently. She has a great leg kick. She has good hooks of her own. And I do think Namajunas has some good power in her shots. Of course, we saw that in the Joanna fight. But for Namajunas, she's going to have to be the one to make Wei Li stop just throwing punches. And that could be hit her with a big shot, earn her respect. That could be go for takedown attempts. But for Rose, I really do think she's going to have to incorporate her ground game sooner rather than later in this fight. Because if she can get her hands around Wei Li and just make her work, I think that's going to be her game plan. Just Jang is really good off her back and getting back up to her feet. So, again, it's not an easy game plan by any means, but I do think Rose has to make this an ugly fight. If she can work it on the inside, now, even that's going to be tough to do because we've seen Naomi Yunus have good success being that outside fighter. I just doubt she's going to be able to get enough leg kicks tallied up to really make a big difference against Wei Li. And one thing Wei Li can do, we saw Yawani and Jacek in the second fight with Rose Naomi Yunus. She threw a lot of leg kicks that Naomi Yunus was not able to check herself. Now, Naomi Yunus has good offensive leg kicks, but defensively, she doesn't check any, so Jang can really start hammering home those leg kicks early and often. I think they will pay off as this fight progresses. I just think Rose is going to have a tough time with not only the power, but the volume of Wei Li. And if Rose can't get the confidence, or at least get the respect of Wei Li at some point in this fight on the feet, I do just see Zhang walking away with a decision. I do think just her forward movement is going to keep Naomi Yunus in a certain defensive shell that won't let her throw back.
Yeah, to me, it is a tricky one. Again, for Rose Naomi Yunus, you can never count her out. I mean, she has two wins over Yawani and Jacek. Zhang Weili only has the one. It was by split. It was close.
And I thought Yawani won.
Yeah, I mean, again, we can agree to disagree on all of this stuff. It was close, though. So you look at a fight like this where Rose, she opened a plus 170. She's at about a plus 163 on best fight odds. Zhang Weili opened a minus 200. Still about there as we speak. The votes on Tapology, 1,090 of them, 75% with Zhang, 49% by decision to 45% by knockout. For the supporters of Naomi Yunus, 25% of all the votes, 65% by decision. I like Zhang Weili. I like Zhang Weili as the fight goes on. I like her on the outside. I like the output. I like the leg kicks. And if it gets into a grappling match, that's where it gets really interesting. If it does happen, I slightly favor Zhang Weili in this fight. And when you really saw her make her rise and then ultimately get the win over Yana, it was like, holy smokes. I mean, I don't know who can beat her. Like, it really is difficult. Because if you finish Jessica Andrade, which is very, very difficult to do, and you have the fights that you've had, it's tough to see somebody beating her. Maybe it's a Suarez. I don't really see it for Naomi Yunus, but I can't wait to see what the fans are thinking about this one.
So, I think Naomi Yunus is going to get this fight to the mat at some point. And I think, and now, I'm going to pick Zhang Weili. I will be very open about that. Rose Naomi Yunus is going to make everybody nervous, though. I do see her having some success on the ground, where it's one of those things where she might get a submission, but it's close to the end of the round. And it's like, ugh, we got lucky on that one. So I am going to pick Zhang Weili, but I do think this will be a very interesting fight and a fight that's going to be entertaining, like I said, no matter where it takes place. Like, if this is 25 minutes of grappling between these two, it should be very entertaining. If it's 25 minutes of striking, it should be the same.
Matt, both of us going with Zhang Weili to get the win and still. And Matt, we have a big time main event on the way. UFC 261, the rematch of UFC 251. Between Kamaru Usman and Jorge Masvidal. This is a full camp Masvidal. This isn't the Versace wearing, pizza eating, private jet riding Masvidal who's coming in on a week's notice. You got full camp Masvidal. Will we get what we got in his fight against Darren Till? Who knows? But I'm really looking forward to that fight. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight in a rematch. Our main event of UFC 261. We have Kamaru Usman taking on Jorge Masvidal. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFNP. With me, as always, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at MattAllenFNP. And Matt, we have a rematch that it's weird. It's just straight up weird. For Jorge Masvidal, he lost his last fight, which was a title bid on incredibly short notice against Kamaru Usman. And he ended up losing that fight. One judge scored one round for him. So 49-46, the other two 50-45s. And for Kamaru Usman, it was definitely his night. I mean, he closed the distance. He wore on Masvidal. He won a typical Kamaru Usman fight. The only difference of the fight that Masvidal had his last time out is the fight that Usman had his last time out. It wasn't against Jorge Masvidal. He took a fight against Gilbert Burns. And listen, did the boys have Burns in that one? I can't remember. One of us did, I think.
We both didn't.
But Burns gave a pretty good account of himself. He had Usman rocked at one point. He looked very, very good. Until Kamaru Usman decided, I'm not playing anymore. And I've learned a few tricks since being at Elevation. And wow, did he put it on Gilbert Burns. And it was a statement win for Kamaru Usman to really silence the doubters who said that this guy is just a wrestler.
Turns out Kamaru Usman, more than just 30%, he can go up to 100% now. And that's the wild thing, because Kamaru Usman, it's rare that you have a champion who continues to improve even after they get the belt. But that's the thing about Usman. We always knew how good his wrestling was on his way up. We always knew how good his cardio was. Now you can see how good his striking is. How, I won't really say we've seen a lot of his submission game just because we haven't, but when you've been so dominant with your wrestling, your clinch control, and your striking, why do you really need a submission game? And when I look at everyone who has a title right now in the UFC, I gotta be honest, Kamaru Usman is the guy I think about when I look at who could be the next generational talent who's not gonna lose their belt for a very long time. Now, I might have given my hand a little early on this prediction, but let's just call it what it is. Kamaru Usman doesn't not have any massive glaring weaknesses in his game. And I know you're probably thinking, oh, well, he is a champion. I'm sure he doesn't. But the thing about Usman, you can't just go in there with a striker's mindset like Jorge Masvidal kind of does have. And that's what concerns me. If you go in there just trying to strike with Kamaru Usman, you're going to get taken down. If you go in there just looking to work your jiu-jitsu against Kamaru Usman, he's going to defend every one of your takedown attempts and force you to become a striker. He really can just do the opposite of whatever your game plan is. And that's what's so fun about Kamaru Usman. No matter who you put him in there with, he's going to show a different thing from his game because his style really is based upon what his opponent's style is. For Jorge Masvidal, do I think he's going to double flying knee Kamaru Usman? Probably not, but I do think his best chance of winning is one of those surprise techniques. I think Jorge Masvidal's biggest advantage in this fight is Mike Brown. Now, you can look at the other side and say, well, Trevor Whitman's a great coach too. But with Trevor Whitman, I kind of know what I'm going to get. He's going to take a wrestler and make them a striker, or he's going to improve the striking ability of his fighter. With Masvidal and Mike Brown, Mike Brown's great at just having those weird things in his fighter's game plan. He's got the calf kicks that Poirier had against Connor. He's got the flying knee that Masvidal used. He's just a really cerebral coach who can always add something new to their fighter's game plan. So it'll be interesting to see what Masvidal brings to this fight to really get Usman to stop going for those takedown attempts. Because let's be honest, Kamaru Usman's going to try to take this fight to the mat. Masvidal's going to try to keep this fight standing. It's just going to be how Usman gets the fight to the clinch and how Masvidal keeps this fight in the middle of the cage.
And I mean, for Masvidal, another two big examples, even recently, Kyoji Horiguchi under Mike Brown. Holy smokes. What about Mateusz Gamrot? Wow, big win a few weeks ago. What can Jorge Masvidal do to cancel out the wrestling and to engage in the striking? And if you want the perfect combination from Jorge Masvidal, bang, bang, and throw in a kick, and he really does a lot of very nice things well, but he has a few signature techniques, great hooks, great shots up the middle, and again, is his takedown defense the best in the UFC? Well, we have a big, big sample size on Jorge Masvidal, and when you compare it to the rest of the guys in the division, 77%, pretty good takedown defense so far. If you look at it, I mean, who was able to take him down? Usman 5 times, so now that weight's the number. Darren Till took him down once, but that was a fight of the night. He won performance of the night in the 2 rounds that we had of that. Apart from that, Demian Maia in a split decision loss, but we go through it. I mean, Jorge Masvidal, very tough guy to take down. And the one thing that you know about Masvidal, if you've ever watched UFC Fight Pass, and if you watch a card on there and it's the early prelims, we're probably a Fight Night Picks fan, but they show the promos of the Kimbo Slice documentary over and over and over and over again. And Jorge was what, like 18 when he fought Ray, Kimbo's protege, and finished him in the backyard? But Jorge Masvidal has come from humble beginnings to be one of the biggest stars in the sport, the BMF champ. Roberto Duran was there to see him fight when he fought, who was it? Was it Nate Diaz?
Yeah.
It was Nate Diaz. So when he won the title, the crazy thing is, though, that was 2 fights ago. That's kind of crazy. That was 1.5 years ago, 2 fights ago. He fights Usman on incredibly short notice, saved a pay-per-view that had other title fights on it, but he saved a pay-per-view, and he ultimately loses it. Did he have a couple of moments? Say what you will. One judge scored a round for him. That's cool. I just don't see any big changes. If you're hoping, or if you're going with Masvidal, you're probably thinking it's going to be like the Askren fight, like the Till fight, like the Cowboy fight, where he just poured it on, where he's pouring so much offense onto his opponent. Did Burns rock Usman? 100%. I mean, we did a fight companion for that one, and I think we went absolutely nuts. So, yeah. Burns? Sure. Burns a little different, though. Burns, tie striker. He can mix in the grappling of his own. He has a great submission game. The guys were former teammates. With Masvidal, the book's kind of out on him. And you could say the same thing for Burns, but for Masvidal, the book's out on him. But, like you brought it up, with Mike Brown and the training partners that Masvidal has afforded, What wrinkle can he add to his game to beat Usman? That's a big question mark that we just don't know.
I really think it's going to come down to the feints of Jorge Masvidal. And I hate it how I'm like, hey, maybe the feints will be the thing. I'm not trying to sound like some MMA hipster, but it's the truth. If you can at least feint the techniques that will make Kamaru Usman think, oh, when I do go for my takedown, I'm going to be met with an uppercut or met with a knee. Those are some of the techniques that will at least make Kamaru Usman strike with you for a little bit. But this is my problem. If Kamaru Usman gets this fight to the mat, it is 100% Kamaru Usman. I'm not concerned about Jorge Masvidal's submission ability. He can get back up to his feet, but really, if it's close, Usman's going to be the one winning. On the feet, Masvidal, in theory, will be winning more moments, but it's not like Usman's some terrible striker now. We have seen him turn more into that great, well-rounded martial artist who's just great at everything now, who can rely on his wrestling. So it will be interesting. Masvidal at 36, though, it does concern me. The fact that his last fight was against Usman, and we haven't seen him at least get a kind of a warm-up fight under his belt, because he didn't look great against Usman. I know it was on short notice. He had to fly across the world, and there was all that jazz and whatnot. But it will be interesting to see how much, A, the crowd plays a factor in this fight, because there was no crowd in the first one. And I would assume that Jorge Masvidal will be the fan favorite, at least in Florida. So it'll be interesting to see how will Kamaru Usman handle the negative energy, if you will, from the crowd. But honestly, I agree with you. I don't see this fight going that much different than their first fight. Could Masvidal have maybe slightly better cardio in this one that he couldn't have on 6 days' notice? Yeah, but other than slightly improved cardio, I still see him being held up against the cage. I still see him get him taken down. So unless Masvidal can land one of those big shots early on in the first, second, or third round, I just don't really know what he's going to do to get Usman off of him.
I mean, you look at the odds for this one. Usman open a minus 300 favorite. He's a minus 422. Average on best fight odds. For the man himself, Jorge Masvidal, game bred open plus 250. He's now at a plus 320. So the moment for us is the Tapology vote. Let's see what the fans are thinking for this one. And out of 1,103 total votes, 88% Usman, 75% by decision. For the 12% that have Masvidal, and I know there's going to be people in the comments section, you let us know, 79% of them have to win by knockout. That's got to be the only way. The guy has two submission wins on his record, and he has 35 pro wins. So Jorge Masvidal, not a submission specialist, is he good on the ground? Sure.
He submitted Michael Chiesa.
He did, and he got submitted by Toby Amada back early at Bellator. It
happens.
The first one, when John Anik was a commentator for Bellator. But Matt, I look at this one again. I have a really, really hard time seeing a big difference in Jorge Masvidal. Not just fight over fight, but really it comes down to what have you done for me lately. For Usman, you beat Masvidal in impressive fashion, short notice or whatnot. You get rocked by Burns once, you come back, and you finish Burns. I don't see Usman, losing the fight. It's tricky, but I don't see him losing the fight. But I do really want to know what the fans are thinking down below in the comment section.
Unless Sabaha Masi, Dustin Poirier, Mike Brown, and Jorge Masvidal have some master game plan that no one's been able to come up with, at least yet, I just don't see how Jorge Masvidal is going to win this fight. Usman's looks so dominant as champion for a reason. It's because he is a dominant champion. And let's be honest, Jorge Masvidal is not the guy who should be in this fight. I do feel like there's other contenders at 170 who might be more deserving of this opportunity. I understand the UFC wants to have a big show and a big fight headlining their first fight back in front of a crowd, but I heavily favor Kamaru Usman in this fight.
Matt, we are both going with and still Kamaru Usman to get the win. And we have a big week in MMA planned coming up. You have one championship, PFL, LFA, KSW, and UFC. We'll have an episode of This Week in MMA, as we always do, back at it again. There's Early Stoppage, the podcast on iTunes and Spotify, as well as some great content at fightnightpicks.com with all of that. But articles and our own Joshua Hart's full card betting guide, he hit last weekend. And if our co-main event didn't fall out, it was like plus 370 odds. So all that being said, make sure you check out the content on the hub, fightnightpicks.com. We're really looking forward to this week. And as we always say, let's get into it.